This oral history compilation was recorded and edited by Frank Hymans from original interviews with 22 persons. The project was commissioned by the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority's Environment Branch and was completed in 2004. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. Main Road number 185, Lawrence Highgrave Drive, the Cliff Road. All names for a coastal route south of Sydney from Stanmore Park to Thirroul. And as roads go, this one is without equal. The road makes its way along some of the most breathtaking coastal scenery in Australia. Graeme Oberg is a local resident.
Oh, it's just incredibly beautiful. It's one of those rare places where the mountains and the cliffs come directly to the edge of the sea. It's just one of those things where you'll have your rainforest, your cliffs, your ocean, all in the one spot.
Charles Simpson is a school teacher who lives at Stanmore Park.
Some mornings I've seen whales, dolphins. As you drove around the cliffs, you can see whale spouts blowing. At other times, with very heavy seas, giant waves crashing so that the sea spray actually came over the road. And others, it's calm, clear blue sky. You could watch lobster fishermen diving off their boats to grab a snagged rope and pull up a lobster pot, which they used to sell in the pubs, lobsters, over the bar. All of those visual images come back, and it was fun going to work.
The European history of the area surrounding Lawrence Highgrave Drive goes back to Captain James Cook. Alice Eyre is an artist living at Scarborough.
Cook tried to get ashore at Waniora Beach down here near Bulleye High School. Saw some natives and tried to get ashore with the longboat. They were driven back by the surf, and the natives got on the beach and waved this spear, so they decided to give it away. So they travelled north up the coast. Next morning, woke up, they were back down at Bulleye again, so they must have travelled past here twice.
The next important event was in 1797, when a longboat of survivors from the sailing ship Sydney Cove, which had run aground in Van Diemen's Land, made it as far north as the New South Wales south coast, until it too was wrecked.
Boatload of sailors got ashore, about 17 I think, and they must have walked completely all the way around the coast, including all around Jervis Bay and everything else like that. By the time they got up here, there apparently were only 5 sailors left, and they met some Aboriginals, and amongst the Aboriginals were 2 from Sydney that told them white men were bad, so they actually speared 2 of them, and 3 of the others ran away and walked along the bottom here, the only way they could go. And there's a plaque up in the park there, noting this is where the first coal in Australia was discovered, just underneath there. They lit a fire for the night on the old coal seam where you can find it, lit a fire on the beach, discovering the coal. And then they walked up through National Park as far as the furthest point, which you can see from here, which is called Cape Providence. Of course, from there they can see a fishing boat out to sea near Watermulla, which rescued them and took them to Sydney. And they reported to Gross, who was then acting governor, that there was good coal found here, and he sent Bass down with a longboat full of Marines. They came down here, apparently got half a dozen bags of coal. He then took the longboat down to Fairy Meadow, saw some Aboriginals, charged up the hill and shot 6 of them, which is very nasty summary justice for the natives. With the discovery of coal, Mitchell the surveyor took it over and was granted it, so it's called Mitchell's Mountain after him. And then he trundled off and discovered his western areas and Mitchell cockatoos named after him, etc., etc. And he never lived here. He then sold it to Judge Hargraves, who was Lawrence Hargraves' father. He had 3 sons. Lawrence was the younger. Lawrence Hargrave was apparently a bit of a tearaway, and he's apparently recorded to be the first man to ever canoe up the Sepik River in New Guinea. and Dad disinherited and said, go away.
After the death of his father and his two brothers, Lawrence Hargrave inherited the property and settled down on the coast. Bruce Fishburne, a former engineer at the Department of Main Roads' Ballambi Works office, recollects.
When I was there, Mrs. Hargrave was the publican at the Clifton Hotel, and there were all types of mementos from the era of, I think it was her grandfather, was Lawrence Hargrave. Now, for some reason, he doesn't really get the true fame that I think is due to him. Lawrence Hargrave was a contemporary of a fellow called Otto Lilienthal, and between he and Lawrence, they had been working on being able to control the flight of these box kites and gliders. Now, if you scratch anyone these days and ask them who was the first person who pioneered flight, they always talk about the Wright brothers, which is rubbish. It was Otto Lilienthal and Lawrence Hargrave. They were the true pioneers. What the Wright brothers did was to put an engine on a device that these other guys had worked out. The true pioneers of flight really rest in guys like Lawrence. And much of the work that he did was done down in this cliff area, and especially up at Ball Point, where he took advantage of the winds just to study what happens. And of course, that's a favourite haunt now of hang glider enthusiasts all over the place. And I suppose that the hang gliders are really just a further development of what these two guys had done.
Leo de Adam first arrived to take charge of the Ballambi Works office in 1963. He speculates on the origins of Lawrence Hargrave Drive.
I spoke to some historians around here years ago, and they led me to believe originally it was an Aboriginal track, and then the cattle were brought into the area and the cattle found their way around. Back in the 1860s, there was a petition made to Parliament for funds to be provided for construction of the road. And no sooner had they commenced on the road, that 200 tonnes of rock came down and wiped it out.
Greg Kotze is Chief Engineering Geologist at GHD Longmac. He's had a long association with the area surrounding Lawrence Hargrave Drive.
The most striking feature about it is the sheer magnitude of the site. The fact that you have the full range of Triassic and late Permian strata exposed at the very top of the escarpment, which occurs above the Lawrence Hargrave Drive rock cliffs, is characterised by Hawkesbury sandstone. So that's middle Triassic of age, and you get the full sequence from the Hawkesbury right down to the Illawarra coal measures. So that covers in time a span of about 40 million years, and from the Hawkesbury down to sea level is about 300 metres. So it's very unusual to have all those strata covering that time span exposed stratigraphically at one location.
So you're actually looking at 40 million years?
All in one glance, that's right. It's quite impressive.
How does the weather and the climate interact with the sandstone? What happens when it does?
Well, sedimentary rocks are all susceptible to weathering and erosion upon exposure to the elements. The sandstones, siltstones and shales, they all react a little differently, but it basically acts to break them down. You get the processes of natural cliffline regression. The site mechanisms are a range of rockfall failure mechanisms, sudden brittle failures, toppling, sliding, right through to debris flows, debris slides, mud slides during wet weather, and embankment failure and subsidence also during wet weather. So it virtually covered the full gambit of geotechnical failure types all in one site area.
Although coal was found as early as 4 years after European settlement, It was not commercially mined in the area surrounding Lawrence Hargrave Drive until 1878, when the Colcliffe mine opened. Mining attracted employment from the surrounding areas, and as new mines set up, villages grew along the coast. Their names were mostly associated with coal mining and the topography. Colcliffe, Clifton, Coaldale. Lynn Bush has researched the early history of Clifton Township and its mine.
When they first started the mine up, they had tent camps along the creek, and there was a, I think it was typhoid, went through the tent village, and they had to all be disrobed. Their tents were burnt, and so was their clothing and all that. You've got to remember that this village, even though it looks small now, in its heyday, there was about 600 to 800 residents here, and there was a Catholic church, Anglican church in the Catholic church. There was two hotels and a stagecoach terminal area where they used to refresh their horses and then they'd be off to Waterfall the next day. It was the link with Sydney and here. Yeah, and they had a baker, they had a butcher, they had a general store, billiard rooms, and a boarding house. Also a convent. And there was a doctor's surgery, a court of petty sessions, and quite a large railway station. Yeah, so you've got to remember that the village itself was self-contained and they didn't have to go out much in early days. But it was the link to where they worked, and it was the link to the jetty. Where the colliers, you know, used to call in and they'd load them.
Gus Forbes, a coal miner and the son of a miner, was born in 1923.
I was born at our house in the bush at Scarborough. My mother was attended by Mrs. Emmett, the midwife, who fulfilled most of these duties at that particular time. We were just virtually coming out of the Depression. We had lived in the bush with no electricity, no running water. My father worked in a coal mine. He came home black, and Mum would put the copper, the 18-gallon copper on, boil the water, and he would have his bath in a round galvanised tub. Things were pretty primitive, no refrigeration. To keep the butter cold, we dug a little hole in the bank of the creek and put it in there. Mum wanted a set of jelly. The same thing happened. Sometimes the jelly set, sometimes it didn't. Some people had ice chests, and the people that had ice chests were considered pretty well off.
Did you have a meat safe? Where you
we had a meat safe, which we hung under the plum tree, and that was our only means of refrigeration. We had a dairy, and we supplied milk to people. Sometimes we got money for it. Sometimes we got eggs or we got fruit.
So it was a bartering system?
A bartering system, and I can remember my dad killed a pig, and the neighbours helped. The pig was cut up and divided amongst the neighbours. And then a week or two on, somebody would kill a calf and the same thing would happen. But neighbours cared for one another. If my mother was sick, there was two or three women that would be there to help out, get the kids to school and do what they could to make themselves. And in those days, you knew everybody in the street. Now you're lucky to know who lives next door. We didn't have locks on the doors. We didn't need to lock our houses. Come to think of it, it was probably because there was nothing worth stealing.
The house that Forbes lived in was rudimentary, but typical for the miners of those times.
To think of it, it was really a fire trap, because in those days a lot of the houses were lined with rubberoid and would burn so fiercely. My mum used to do a spring cleaning and she would calcimine that rubberoid, make the place look as good as it could be under the circumstances. A lot of the inside lining in the houses in those days was done with sugar bags cemented over.
What was the floor made of?
Sometimes, for a long while, there was a lot of bare floors.
When you say bare floor, do you mean dirt floor?
Dirt floor, yes.
How did people get through the Depression in this area, do you think?
They were lucky because they had the sea. You find most people fish here. Even today, we still fish. We get our fish from the sea. We don't go and buy it.
There were some boats, fishing boats, propelled by oars. They would catch fish and that was divided. And then there was some lot of divers would go down the coast getting lobsters, because in those days I can remember going in the water and lobsters were like lice, they were everywhere.
So you used to have often lobster for dinner?
Often lobster for dinner. Never ever appreciated lobsters and could not understand why somebody would pay $42 a kilo for them today. We couldn't give them away.
Did you eat rabbits as well? During
had rabbits. I can remember there was a horse and cart used to come around selling rabbits, sixpence a pair. And then it went up to ninepence a pair and everyone swore off eating rabbits. It was too dear. Did a lot of time trapping rabbits and sleeping out over wherever we went. We just took a blanket and tin of sardines and tin of baked beans and half a loaf of bread and a knife and camped out. Always found a creek to camp by and boil a billy, and it was a great life.
They used to make pants out of the flour bags, and they used to cut them up and make the kids' pants out of them. They used to laugh because they had flour or the name of something written across their bottom or their front of them.
Did they wear shoes?
No. That was one thing. They didn't have shoes. No.
Elaine Pugh lives at Stanwell Park. Her father-in-law, the policeman at Scarborough, witnessed many acts of desperation.
One lady decided to end it all, and to do that she had to strip off all her clothes. She went and lay down on the railway lines naked, and they came running down to the police station, "Mr. Pugh, Mr. Pugh, you have to come and get her off the railway line, the paper train will be coming through." And she was on a section of the line where the banks were steep at the side, and she wouldn't get up, and he had to put her over his shoulders in a fireman's lift and haul her up the bank. And then there were huts up in the bush, depression huts, where people had gone and just squatted and lived up there in the bush. And there were old men that lived up there that used to come down to the Clifton Post Office to get their pension every fortnight. And if they didn't arrive, the post office would contact the policeman who'd get the Ostermere man up, and they'd go up to find the body.
For the children of the 8 villages along Lawrence Hargrave Drive, things were much happier. They enjoyed the kind of freedom that would be envied today. Brian Harvey, a Clifton resident, remembers.
There was a lot of kids in the town from various ages and stages, and we had a hell of a good time in Clifton. You know, in the summer time, we lived at the beach, and in the winter time, we went up the mountain. We used to get Frankfurt's at Les Nichols' store, which was under the School of Arts, and we'd take them up to the top of the mountain and get a fire going and roast these Frankfurt's and put them on bread and then walk back down home after we'd had dinner. That was another one of the favourite exploits. And over on the park over in Eo, of an afternoon, evening, we'd be playing cricket or football or hide and seek or whatever. There was always something going on, but, you know, looking back on it, well, it was a great time. We had a great time.
We used to play cricket on the main road. So we'd put up a fruit box and the thing, and quite honestly, we could play there for 4 hours and maybe having to move that box once or twice.
Warren de Kluwert, who grew up at Scarborough, has similar memories.
It sort of wasn't a road, it was a track virtually, you know. I mean, you could walk in the middle, you were never going to have to get off for cars or bikes or anything, you know. So you virtually had the road to yourself. The old school bell would go and you'd see kids running and all that. It was quite a big school, you know, years ago, Scarborough, because they were building the railway line and they had a terrible lot of fettlers, you know, like railway workers, you know. And up near the school, the families used to live in tents, you know, big tents, while the fathers were working on the railway line. And I can remember all those children used to go to school.
The families along Lawrence Hargrave Drive had very different habits to those who live there today.
When we come home from school, we always had a hot dinner, because that's when my father came home, 3 o'clock. That was tea time, all them years ago, and believe it, that was all families. And then my father would have his hot tea and whatever, and then up the pub.
I can remember the first car that went over Wambara Heights, and it was a little red Austin owned by Mr. Croft. And I don't know whether Johnny Baines told you about his father and the first car he had. He bought a Prefect. And the story goes that Lawrence Baines went to Sydney and bought this Ford Prefect. And he drove it home in low gear or second gear because he didn't know how to change gears. And anybody that knew anything about a motor vehicle, he was a saint, because we knew all about horses and sulkies. We knew how to change wheels on sulkies and things like that. But a motor car, that was something different.
In 1939, World War II came to Lawrence Hargrave Drive. John Baines, now a concrete contractor, recalls the presence of the armed forces during those years.
You know, there used to be blackouts and things all the way along the coast, and they had wardens in each town that used to get alarmed, and they used to come around and do patrols and make sure you had blackout paper up to your windows. So there was quite a bit of fear, and I can remember big convoys of boats coming through.
I can remember army trucks going through at different times, you know, with soldiers on them. They had a camp down at the bottom of Clifton Hill. I think there was 4 soldiers and a sergeant or whatever rank, I don't know, I can't remember now, but they had the road dynamited between the bottom of Clifton Hill and what they call the amphitheatre there now, and it was loaded up to be blown up if the Japs invaded us.
Charles Simpson adds,
during World War II, we've been reliably informed by a number of locals that the American Corps of Engineers, who were in Australia at that stage, offered to rebuild the road by their simple method of blasting 3/4 of the cliffs out and building a viaduct from Colcliffe to Clifton. Most of the locals were of the opinion the New South Wales government should have taken that offer. It was a free offer, and they never took them up on it.
Gloria Buren spent the war years in Brisbane, working as head waitress at the Queensland Club.
I had a wonderful time. It was a jumping off spot for the campaign in the South Pacific, like, and there was about 100 men to every woman. We used to go out dancing nearly every night of the week. You had to go and look after the troops, like, and we had to be in at midnight, otherwise the doorman would lock us out.
Gloria met her husband Jack, a miner from Thirroul, when he returned from fighting in Papua New Guinea, and they settled at Clifton. Their first house was a cottage owned by the colliery.
It was a weatherboard house, badly in need of paint, with a leaking corrugated iron roof. Of course, the house had been there that long, when a real windy night, all the coal dust that was stored in the roof used to come down. Of course, it had one of those ceilings, sort of board ceiling, and down you go out in the morning and everything in the kitchen be covered in coal dust. So I had plenty to do. But like everyone was in the same boat, we were all quite happy. And along the road a bit there, used to have his cows up there wandering round and his horses. And when my son got older, he bought a pony. We bought it for him for his birthday. And used to just roam up there, and our front verandah was on the street, and the horse would stand there if he wanted anything and hang his head over the front verandah. goodness me, things were different in those days. And often a rocket come roaring down the mountain. There was a house up the top of the street on the left. One night after heavy rain, these rocks used to come pounding down. And this great rock came down and wiped out their laundry and shed and practically the back of the house. But no one was hurt. But rocks would often come down.
How did the locals react to all those rock falls? Were they sort of taking it all in their stride?
Yes. There was an old lady lived across the line here. She was terribly lucky. She had this big long house she'd lived in all her life. And just after she died, this great rock came down and wiped the house out. It was real strange. I'll never forget it. We went up to have a look like, and it was a long house like the rooms beside one another. And the whole place, they had this great big rock in the middle of it.
The majority of people who lived along Lawrence Hargrave Drive at that time had little secondary education, and for the young men, there was little choice of occupation, as Ron Draper found.
You just practically left school and walked straight into a job, which was mainly the pit or the steelworks.
Were they the only two options available to you, were they?
And about that time, yes. Or the railway.
Stan Rees started at Coalcliffe Colliery when he was only 14. His father had a similar working background.
He was a miner, he was a Welshman, came out here and started up at Coalcliffe. His father was a miner. Once you got coal mining in your blood, it seems to stick in there. It was the old pick and shovel days. They draw for different sections of the mine. They used to draw for positions. If you got a good draw, well, you made money. If you didn't, well, you was battling. And they worked hard. I've seen chaps there. Of course, there was no such a thing as compensation them days. And they'd come and they'd be working in their missus's corset because they'd have a broken rib. Because if you didn't work, you didn't get any money. You know, you'd see blokes coming with broken fingers and, oh, terrible it was.
The day after I turned 16... I must have been a bit of a torment to my mother because she was working in the shop and I was tormenting her. And she said, for goodness sake, go and get yourself a job. So off I went. I went along to the pit and I saw Bill Sweeney, who was the pay clerk. I said, I want a job, Mr. Sweeney. And he said, you can start tomorrow. So I started tomorrow. I went home and told Mum. She nearly had a fit, didn't want her son in the coal mine. Anyway, I stopped in there just on 12 months. I was a clipper. That is clipping the full coal onto the endless rope to take it to the surface and clip off the empties that came on the reverse rope.
Ron Draper reflects.
The skips had come up in the cage and the onsetter had to pull a lever to let them out. They went down onto the weighbridge where they had a leather token on it, leather with a number stamped on it. And this bloke used to yell it out inside to the two weighmen. There was a company weighman and a federation weighman. That's the union weighman. And they'd take the number and the weight, and that's what the miner got paid on. And then it'd go from there and up a creeper. And the skip used to bump back on it, and it'd come up and go off at the top. And we had to sprag him from there down to the next bloke. He'd change the points from one tumbler to the next, and they'd bump the empty out. He'd pull the lever as they went in, which would lock the things on the bottom of them, and pull the other lever up with his other hand, and the skip would turn over and empty down into the shakers, the screens. And what you done down there was you picked the stone out before it went down into the railway wagons, or the best amount that you could. A lot of our coal went to White Bay Powerhouse or the railway.
My first job was at South Clifton, where my dad and my uncles worked. And it's the best job that I've ever had in my life. I couldn't wait to get to work. Honestly, I used to run to work, just to be able to go down the coal mine and just sit with them men and listen to some of their stories. That were just so unbelievable, stories. And just to sit there and listen to them and work with them and learn off them, and which I did.
After the first year as a clipper, Gus Forbes took on the job of wheeler.
In those days, you walked 3 mile in with your horses. You walked 3 mile out. There was no transport. You had to take the powder in on one of the horses. There was no water in the mine in those days. We didn't get the water in until we got the machinery in. And I was 23 years of age. I was as fit as a fiddle. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. And I would go to sleep at the tea table. It was slavery. Nobody should work that hard. Nobody does work that hard anymore. You chased horses. They were tandem horses. You had a lead horse and a body horse. And you really, really worked hard. You earned every penny you got. And I was on the machine wheelers were the highest paid wheelers. It was 23 and a penny a day.
Now, these horses, were they ponies?
Well, they were big horses and big horses, yeah. Yeah, well, they were average-sized horse, very nuggety, very good. And, of course, the horses got to know what they had to do. Each wheeler treated his horse as his own, more or less. And then every weekend, they'd bring the horses up out of the mine and the horses would come up for the weekend. It was a sight to see them come out when you see 50 horses coming out. You'd see them coming out and they'd just go berserk seeing the sunlight because they was down there. Sometimes they wouldn't bring them out of a weekend and they'd be down there for a fortnight, 3 weeks, never even see the sun or anything. It was really a cruel thing for the animals.
How deep did they work?
They worked right in the mine, right at the coal face, 2 or 3 miles. The horses knew their way in, where they were going. It was dark, and, you know, no light or anything. Cause at that time, you only had lights that used to hang on your belt, not the headlights.
Dust was another hazard in the mines.
You couldn't see for dust there at times, and that's how a lot of the dusted miners came about, coal dust.
How did it affect their health?
Oh, very bad. Once they got over 50, they was finished, really. You couldn't hear them breathing and coughing and spitting, you know. But they had to work because otherwise they starved. Of course, they couldn't retire or anything. It was no retirement age them day. They'd work till properly they dropped dead or they couldn't work any longer.
Now, how dangerous was it really to be working every day in the mines?
Every time that anyone drops their head to walk into a coal mine is dangerous, very dangerous. I saw a lot of bad accidents in the mine, and one that will stay with me forever and ever is the night that Billy Band, a fitter in the mine, only been married 12 months, he got killed. Well, I was working on the stone at number 12. We'd just gone back after the Christmas break. We got a phone call to say it was a bad accident down in 16. I was pretty fit in those days, and about 20 of us took off. I must have beaten by about 200 yards. It was the labourer to Billy was Skin Ainsley. He was at the power box disconnecting the power. He couldn't talk. He's crying. He just pointed, and away I went. I saw the light under the Brattis, and I ducked under it, and there was the loader, and I see Billy underneath it. I crawled under it, felt his pulse. It was dead. There was no pulse. I knew he was dead before we got under. We got to the transport and put the stretcher on one of the cars. We all got on. Nobody spoke, not one word all the way out. There wasn't a dry eye on that transport. We got outside. Half the town is there because when there was a bad accident, they blew the whistle and everyone knew there was an accident. They didn't know who or what, so they've all turned up. There was a lot of relieved faces when they found out that it wasn't one of theirs. And it was Gracie Band was... She was the one that didn't have the relief on her face, and that's something that'll stay with me. But other accidents, I've seen horses killed, which is a sad thing in itself, because when you're a wheeler, nobody could say anything they liked about your horses. You could say what you liked, but if somebody else hit your horses, it was knuckles of trumps. So you just had something with those horses. You loved your horses. And to see a horse get killed is a terrible thing.
Oh, there was always accidents. The main accidents were once the machinery started. You had to be very careful because of these machines that took up the full width of the driveway. It was just like trucks going along the main road. You had to be careful and that because there were big machines with coal coming out of the mine. And when you were extracting coal was the worst part, extracting the pillars. Of course, then you get the fall, sometimes bury the miner, and stone might weigh a ton or something, it'd come out, just drop out of the roof. Boom. While I worked up here, there must have been about four deaths.
Chappies getting hurt or killed in the pit happened all the time. My husband was badly injured once, like, and they rang me. Who was it? Oh, the hospital, I think, rang me and said they had Jack there and would I come down? He didn't know me at first. He had a bad fall of coal, hit him on the head. And what else was that with him? I think his arm was broken and a leg. He was a bit of a mess for a while, but they looked after him well at the hospital and he was quite happy there. He was off work for about 6 months because our little hospital at Culldale, the miners built that. It's a big hospital now. It's just all been rebuilt. It's really something.
Throughout all this time, Lawrence Hargrave Drive was the lifeline that linked the 8 small villages and the coal mines along its route. But the road was subject to rockfalls, mudslides and slippages, especially after heavy storms.
I remember the big storm in 1950. There was huge rains everywhere at that time. There was floods in the inland rivers, and that road was closed from Easter Thursday till about a fortnight before Christmas.
Elaine Pugh's father-in-law, the policeman at Scarborough, was summoned to the scene.
He was rung and told in the middle of the night to get himself along there that the road had slid into the sea between Scarborough and Clifton, and to get up there and set up lanterns to warn anybody. And as he went out of the front gate of the police station, a utility truck went through. He shouted, but the wind was blowing and the rain was pouring down, and he thought, there'll be one at the bottom when I get there. And when he got there, the utility was pulled up a couple of foot from the edge. It was the NRMA man from Thirroul, and he didn't know why he'd pulled up. He had no idea what made him stop. And the whole road went into the sea. And their backyard at the police station, they got up in the morning and the back fence was hanging in midair and the land had fallen down the cliff. He said it was a very eerie experience.
Mark Hendricks is a geologist who has researched the history of Lawrence Hargrave Drive.
There's a couple of newspaper articles that mention this major collapse in 1950. One of the quotes, this is from the South Coast Times on the 5th of June 1950, when they're considering what they're going to do with it all. This is after gangs have been working for 2 months on the road, and the comment is that it'll be another 2 months before the road is trafficable. And there's a quote here that engineers, after viewing the wide fissures in the cliff face below the road, shake their heads and express the opinion that the task is most difficult, if not hopeless.
In 1950... we had that wet winter and the road was closed here for about 5 months, and Clifton Hill was just one great big bog heap, and they'd never done anything to it or tried to clear it, and a bloke got injured at Calcliffe Colliery and the ambulance had to go right around and he nearly died. And the miners had a meeting the next morning and they said, well, we're not going to work again until they put a road through round the cliffs and clear the cliffs. So they put a bulldozer in one morning, and at dinner time the next day they had a one-way track through. So it's marvellous, the power of people.
What caused the road collapse of 1950 and subsequent similar events? Bob Webb, Road Services Manager at the RTA Southern Region, explains.
We have this escarpment line which over millions of years erodes and collapses, and that forms a matrix of clay and rock pieces which is quite permeable, and there's water fed into that by the coal seams which are quite pervious, and so it saturates this material. You get a long wet period and then a big event, you get these large areas of talus which then become saturated and become unstable under their own weight largely, and that causes a collapse.
Because of concerns about the safety of Lawrence Hargrave Drive, in the late 1940s, the Department of Main Roads had commissioned Laurie Waterhouse, a leading engineering geologist, to prepare a report on what to do about the road. The storm of 1950 only increased the urgency to find a solution. Mark Hendricks comments.
The Waterhouse report was incredibly important in terms of the history of the road and in terms of our current remediation studies. There was actually a reference in the RTA library to a report by Laurie Waterhouse, and I'd asked them for the copy of this report, and they'd come back and said, oh, it's been lost. And I thought, oh, damn, you know, this was going to be a very useful report. And just on the odd chance, I sent an email down to Val Brisker, who's the scientific officer in Wollongong, and he managed to come up with a photocopy of it. And it was this report detailing the engineering geology between Colcliffe and Clifton. It was just one of the most detailed engineering geology reports I've ever seen. It was absolutely brilliant. Detailed site observations and detailed mapping. The maps were beautifully hand-coloured by watercolours. This report by Laurie Waterhouse was incredibly important, and it is amazing to me that it had not been looked at in relation to Lawrence Hargrave Drive in modern times. So this report was absolute godsend, and without it we would have to, again, spend a lot of time doing detailed mapping to get to the same point. So Waterhouse has saved us a lot of time and money. It's interesting to think what happened between him handing in the report to the then DMR in 1952 and the subsequent work that's been done on the road up to present, because it almost seems like the report was buried somewhere. Waterhouse provided a host of remediation options for fixing the problem, and these included things like redirecting the road to different parts of the slope, to tunnelling, to bridging options. It included also roof protection, so having rockfall protection devices above the road.
So what were his final recommendations?
Waterhouse basically, in lieu of not having a large amount of money, Waterhouse believed that the best way to deal with public safety was actually to close the road.
But that wasn't an option, was it really?
Not for the government at the time, no.
Professor Waterhouse made the comment in his report that it should be closed. He reckoned it was a dangerous road. And we've said that all along. But the one factor that kept it going was the coal mine up there. Over those years, coal was very scarce, power supplies, etc., etc. So it was a dominant factor in keeping the road going.
During his investigations, Waterhouse witnessed an actual rockfall on a furniture truck in 1949. John Baines, who drove that truck, has vivid memories of that day.
I was asked to cart some furniture from Mr. Hawkins that had the general store in Scarborough. Fend and I went and loaded it on. We got going, we were going around the cliffs, and there was a loud bang on the side of the truck, and I come to a stop. Side and I jumped out, and here was a hole about 2 foot across in a wardrobe on the side of the truck and a hole in the tarpaulin. So I climbed up, had a look in, and there's a big rock sitting in the middle of the truck, right on top of a typewriter.
The SP bookie, he was going home one night, and it was raining like anything, and that, and these rocks were on the road in the amphitheatre, so he decided he'd get out and get them out the road so he could get through a bit better. And he heard some more coming, so he jumped in the car and drove the car straight over the top of it.
It was a type of road that you could never trust in that it would remain stable because of the nature of the geological formations of the area. That's quite unstable. I was always worried that a major catastrophe could happen given the right circumstances.
What was the locals' attitude towards all these rockfalls? Were they afraid to drive on that road?
Surprisingly, no. They'd grown up with it, And in those days, I don't know what they do now, we used to just pick the rocks up and dump them over the other side, you know.
In 1954, the young Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip were to visit Wollongong, and they were to take the scenic route on Lawrence Hargrave Drive, but this was not to be. Mark Hendricks reflects.
The touring royals were diverted from using Lawrence Hargrave Drive for fear of rockfalls, and the local residents kicked up quite a stink about this, because they were using the road all the time, and so were their kids and school buses.
It was deemed too dangerous for the Queen to travel down that road, so she went to Wollongong in the royal train.
In the 1950s, the DMR hired a man to look after the road. His name was Bert Cheetham.
They hired a man who had a spade and a shovel, and his job was to walk around the cliffs and shovel any small rocks off the road, use the broom and then the shovel, and he'd throw them into the sea. And if there was a serious rockfall that he couldn't lift off with the shovel, he would then go to the hotel, because that was the nearest phone, ring up the old Department of Main Roads headquarters in Wollongong, and they would send a team of workers out with the appropriate equipment.
He worked on that road between Colcliffe and Clifton, and that road used to be kept spotless by that man. I mean spotless.
He used to come up from Carldale on a push bike, and he'd start there at one end, and he'd go right to, and he'd work, he wouldn't sit, he'd work for his 8 hours. Any hour when Albert went, they didn't replace him. I think they replaced him with the chap for about 3 months, and he retired, and that was it.
When he was employed, it was very, very rarely that the road was cut. All of the locals were of the opinion that when he retired, that was when most of the trouble with rockfalls began.
But even Bert Cheetham, diligent as he was, could not stop the rockfalls, which always seemed to follow extreme weather events. Leo Diana relives an incident one evening in 1965.
There was a group of men repairing the road in the evening. It had slipped during the day and they kept working. And I went out there and it was raining, very violent weather with very strong winds. But the men kept working and it was just coming on towards the change of shifts at the coal mine. It would have been about 10-ish in the evening. And we held the men, about 10 to 15 cars up, miners going to the night shift, and we just finished gravelling, and I let the miners go through, and we no sooner were just tidying up there and we're dumping another load of gravel, and the truck was tipped up, we hear a rumble up top, and down come this massive rock. Well, it must have been at least 30, 40 tonnes or more. And the tip truck was tipping the material and its tailgate was swinging, and the rock completely took the tailgate. It was by good fortune that we did not have any fatalities that night. We could have lost a fair few people, coal miners in their cars. They would have been sitting ducks. And the truck, it would have been another metre back, would have taken it with it. And I was only about 5 or 6 metres from where the rock went through, so it put the fear of life into me. And I never, from there on, sanctioned that repairs would be undertaken in the evening. Doesn't matter what emergency, and we immediately closed the road off. That was in my day. I don't know what happened afterwards.
But rockfalls were not the only hazard along Lawrence Hargrave Drive. After major storms and water saturation, the embankment was subject to slippage and collapse.
In 1963, a man died when his car went into the ocean. Apparently, the coroners and the police reports of the time suggest that an embankment failure was partly to blame.
I can remember Bobby Poole when he went over in the car, but I didn't see that, didn't know the next day. He lived at Colcliffe here, and his son used to kick around with my son, and that's how we knew it was Bobby. Like, he said his father hadn't come home that night from Clifton. And we went around there, and you could see where the car had gone through the fence. And that was more or less caused by a slip in the road too, and it hadn't been fixed up for quite some time. It wasn't fixed up till after the accident. You could see the crack it had. In the old time, it would be 3-inch drop. It was on that hairpin bend, yeah. And there was no car. Never ever found the car. It went into the sea. Never ever found it.
But they found his body?
Yeah, his body was there because I had to identify him down at the morgue.
Which year was that?
63.
Same year, I think in December, another accident occurred at the same spot. In which a loaded coal truck drove over the edge and the driver died in hospital the next day after being recovered. Again, there was a coroner's investigation into this death, and it turns out that the coal truck had broken down, was fully loaded with coal, heading to the Coalcliff Coke Works, and the driver reportedly called for assistance and he was towed by another truck, and the connection between the two failed just at this particular corner. And the truck went through the guard fence again and ended up down the slope.
There have been many attempts made by the DMR and the RTA to solve the problem of rockfalls. Some of the ideas proposed verged on the bizarre. Leo D'Adam recounts.
I made a silly suggestion at one stage that we bring in a destroyer, set her up in the bay there and just use it as gun practice and bring down the cliffs. I thought it was a good suggestion at the time.
In 1966, Bruce Fishburne was transferred to the DMR's Bulambi Works office, which was then in charge of Lawrence Hargrave Drive.
When I arrived at Bulambi, a fellow called George King was the divisional engineer, and George was a very nice guy to work with once you got to know him. Very correct man. Very dapper little man. A little guy. Always used to get around in a little trilby hat and a waistcoat and all that. And had a real sense of decorum and things like that. He was a golf ball king. He used to have this golf ball that used to bounce on the top of the pavement. And that was his test to make sure that it was dense enough. If the golf ball bounced back to roughly the height that he dropped it from, it was good pavement. If it didn't, he'd sort of have a few words to say. Anyway, George then was replaced by Jeff Thompson. Now, the problems probably started around towards the end of 1967 when there was quite a lot of rain, and I think the catalyst really was a school bus that went through and it got hit by some stones, and people then started to raise the alarm bells. And Jeff Thompson sort of reckoned that really the level of risk was getting to a stage that we'd better get some help. And so he went up to Sydney and had a talk to various people there. And can I sort of comment that I have never seen or heard of so many wacko ideas out of this advice that Jeff got. And included in that was the idea that all these pieces of rock that were sort of hanging there could actually be loosened by hitting them with a wrecking ball type of arrangement. So much to my disgust, I finally agreed that what we would do was to give this a trial. And so what we did was to organise to get a pile-driving winch, and we put that on site down the bottom. And then we had to put an anchor up the other end to hang on to the other end of a rope. And the idea was that we were going to have a rope that was anchored both ends, and from this rope we were going to hang a pulley. And on the pulley, we were going to use the twin drum pile driving winch both to pull it up and down the rope and also to lift the weight up and down. Anyway, coming back to the wrecking ball, we then had our first trial with that with a great deal of ceremony, and it was hopeless. It really was hopeless. I think we spent all day and got about, we did get some rocks down, but it really wasn't worth the effort. Because, it was quite massive sandstone. And you just go dong, and it'd come back dong, and do it again, and little chips would fall off. And what we found was the most successful was actually to pull this pile-driving hammer, lower it right down to the bottom of the slope, and drag it back up the face, and it would then hook under the rocks, and that would then pull them out. And that was quite effective. But when you pull them out, there was just another layer behind them, and we didn't fix the problem. and I was of the view that there really was nothing that would fix the problem.
The history of Lawrence Hargrave Drive during pre-European times cannot be documented, but there are Aboriginal oral history accounts brought down through the generations. Alan Carriage is a tribal elder from the Wadi Wadi Nation.
My original name is Gerongonga, which are porpoises. This word Gerongong, but it's named too from the porpoise. There is tribes in these areas, and the Wadi Wadi Nation, we're one of the main tribes in this area. From Botany Bay, they lived right through to, down the coast, we went as far as the Shoalhaven River. We were the first people, my tribe was the first people to help colonisation, because when they landed near Kaiaman coastline there, they had scabies and sores all over them, that my people healed them, fixed them up, and saved some of their lives and their legs with the bush medicine, which I know some of it, my mum taught me. I know some good bush medicine, actually, and good marine bush medicine too. Iron in for pregnant women and stuff like this, I know all that stuff mum taught me. We grew up around Hill 60, that's in Port Kembla. We lived on official camps, and my mum was born in Hill 60 in a tin shack. And my brother was born in the old hospital at Port Kembla, next to the swamp, the Kermadichi Swamp, my brother was born. Before mum came back to have Peter, I was sort of on the run, a fugitive with my mother, because the welfare was chasing me. I was still in my mum's belly. Unreal, isn't it?
Could the welfare have taken you away?
Oh, they could have done anything. We never had a hope. They could have done anything with us. I mean, my mum used to hide us in the sandhills. We knew the sandhills backwards there at Port Kembla. My mum used to say to me and Peter, "You boys go and get something for tea." So away we go, me and my brother. He was younger than I. We'd go down, we used to dive for lobsters, abalone. That was our food. Lobsters, abalone, oysters, sea urchins, kanji boy, all the top food in the world. It was just there for us to live on, as bush tucker and marine tucker, whatever you want to call it, you know. Sometimes we used to try and get some kangaroo meat. Mum used to cook up the wonga pigeon, birds. I know all the berries. I can go into the bush and get a feed of berries. It's, you know, like, it's a very finely tuned diet we had. So anyway, we'd get home, and Mum used to say, she'd cook it all up. And we used to live in a bar company. She'd cook it all up, and she'd put it on this big old wooden table we used to have. And she'd say, I wonder what the rich people are eating tonight. And I used to be so damn naive when I was a little fella. I said, "Oh, yeah, Mum, they've got more money than us. They'd be eating better than us." And she just used to laugh at me, you know.
What sort of education did you have?
I don't know. I think I started in first class and I finished in first class, mate. I can't read and write. When I did go to school, what school I went to, the teachers tried to teach me that I was Maori. That my people were bad people. We used to kill all white men and come onto our land. That's what they taught me at school, you know. I could not learn read and writing because I had that attitude put on me about being a bad Aboriginal person, because they tried to change me, but I didn't want to change because I knew I was Aboriginal.
Do any features along this coastline have a particular meaning or a place in Aboriginal thinking?
The scarpin has. The scarpin itself. It's the backbone of my people's spirituality. The scarpin at the back has got thousands of caves in it. And we've got drawings, big drawings in the cave of whales and all different sorts of fish. My mum only told me a little bit about legends. It's about five sisters to six sisters. This is why the mountains are all joined, because the evil things come from the sea, and my sisters wanted to protect the evil stuff from coming onto land. And so they gave their life, and they went up and they held each other's hands, and that's the escarpment running along the back of Wollongong. And in my culture, that the evil things were the sailing ships. That's, we tried to stop from coming on the land, as five or six sisters. And that's the story of colonisation. I don't want to go really into the bad stuff, because my mum said not to go into bad stuff, just try and fix up what you have, you know.
We asked Alan whether his people ever walked along the foot of the escarpment, where Lawrence Hargrave Drive is now.
My old people wouldn't walk through there because the rocks used to fall all the time. A little pebble would fall off the top of that and hit you on top of there, it'll go right through the top of your head. You've got to be careful at all times. That's why my people never walked down through there much. They try to avoid it.
Your people were smarter.
Yeah, they were very smart. They were. They wouldn't go any like, we know this party, and we wouldn't endanger our lives to do it, you know.
It's only the white man that builds a road through these parts, is it?
I suppose you could say that, yeah. We just used it as a track, and I'll tell you what, it was a fast track too. But that's why my people come up over the top.
Throughout the 1970s and 1980s, the rock falls and slippages continued, although to somewhat of a lesser extent. Then, in 1987, a huge rock came down without warning. Bob Webb explains.
There was a big slab came down during the night. We went out the next morning and not only was the road completely blocked by 200 ton out of rock, but there was another large slab hanging next to it that we were concerned was fragile and would also fall. So we arranged to get a contractor in to drill and blast that slab. It had been in the media, the road was closed, so the media came up to see the blast. We loaded it up and he let it off and the smoke cleared and the rock was still there, stuck grimly to the face. So we had to come back and drill and load it again and bring it down.
...1988 was another momentous year for the coast, with a 1-in-30-year storm event that hit with incredible force.
On the night of the 30th of April, the morning of the 1st of May in 88, we had a monumental rainstorm hit the area. It was particularly intense around Coalcliffs, Stanwell Park area, but it also struck much of the Illawarra and caused immense damage on the road system all around the Illawarra. And at the cliff section on Lawrence Hargrave Drive, we had a massive slip in the amphitheatre develop where the road dropped about 1 to 1.5 metres. Another section of road towards the southern end of that section was completely washed away. We had a large number of small slips develop under the road. We had 1,300 cubic metres of debris washed down onto the road from higher up. It consisted of mud and boulders. There was a car trapped in the amphitheatre. We never found the driver. No one ever came to claim the car. We never found a body. Nobody was reported missing. It created monumental damage through that 1.5 kilometre length.
I drove around the cliffs and up the Coalcliff Hill on Lawrence Hargrave Drive 15 minutes before the flash flood came, which washed 6 cars into the creek and people barely escaped with their lives. I was driving around rocks on the road and water pouring over the top of the escarpment, not down the normal watercourses, but arching out. And I was driving, weaving in and out on the roads. That was the scariest time, and of course the road was shut, as were half the roads in Wollongong for weeks afterwards.
They ring up and said, the road's gone. So when I went out there to look at it, I said, it's more than gone.
The road basically fell into the ocean in places. And there's one particularly spectacular failure that occurred, which shows perhaps several metres of the road that just simply dropped away into the ocean, with a guardrail hanging free in space.
We had to transport a lady that was pregnant. We carried her around the road on a stretcher because there'd been a couple of rocks come down, you know, and the fire engine couldn't get through, you know. She was in labour and we had to carry her quite a few hundred yards, you know, and then the ambulance was waiting on the other side of the road, which hadn't fallen in, you know.
A house, an old weatherboard house, about 3 blocks up from the hotel, that completely slipped down the side of the road, and it ended up at an angle of about 20 odd degrees where you would walk up a hallway, and it was moved towards the sea by at least 20 or 30 feet.
People don't realise that between the Scarborough pub and the Coalcliff pub, there used to be lots of houses that slipped over the hill. No longer there. The land here flows when it gets wet. It is unique in the geology of the area, the way that everything flows and crumbles here.
As if events on Lawrence Hargrave Drive in 1988 weren't enough, a railway embankment failure at Coaldale occurred. Bob Webb explains.
Back in 88, when we had the big event, the railways had major problems on their line. They had a catastrophe at Coaldale where the earth fill collapsed because it saturated and it fell into a house below, and a young mother and her child were killed. They had major instabilities in the viaduct at Stanwell Park. They had slip stability problems at Clifton above our road where the whole formation, whole mountain in fact, was moving. And they had problems with the tunnel in behind there. The amphitheatre where the tunnel was shedding rocks onto the railway line.
The railways and the DMR began to repair the damage, which continued throughout most of 1988. The remediation work was extensive.
We had to develop techniques to repair a lot of these areas. Below the road we had the really big slip in the amphitheatre to repair. We repaired that using a technique that had been trialled just the year before on Lawrence Hargrave Drive, putting in transverse rubble drains, which take the moisture out, and we use slag as rubble, which is quite strong. Where the road had virtually disappeared, we used a terra mesh wall using gabion boxes, rock-filled gabion boxes, reinforced back into the fill using layers of mesh. A lot of the things we used for the first time, we put in quite a number of PVC drainage lines. We were able to shift the road in the amphitheatre towards the sea and leave a large rockfall pit which catches a lot of the rockfall in the amphitheatre area, and that was very successful in reducing the rockfall on the road in that area.
Mel Bedanivsky is asset manager at the RTA's Southern Regional Office in Wollongong. He reveals the challenge facing the remediation work in 1988.
The challenge is trying to find a permanent solution. The reality is there was no permanent solution, so it's really trying to restore the road to give us as long a service life as possible, always recognising that we couldn't ever fully repair the road along the existing line with the talus below us and rockfalls and the weathering cliff line above us. But the challenge there was to try and design a road in an area which we knew it had finite life.
As the perils of driving on Lawrence Hargrave Drive continued, the RTA asked their geotechnical staff to find a solution. They approached Greg Wan, a geotechnical scientist at the Blacktown office.
Well, the first thing that I did was to look at the nature and the extent of the rockfall problem, and I found that the rockfall zone came from a certain area of the cliff line. At the same time, we purchased a rockfall program from the United States called the Colorado Rockfall Program, and that assisted us in trying to model the trajectories of the rocks as they came off the cliffs onto the road. This particular program models the bounce effects of rocks falling from a height down a slope or a vertical incline, and using basically Newtonian physical laws, models the trajectory and the path and where the rocks will land. The program assisted us in developing a whole range of options on how to contain the rockfall problem by building a 5 metre berm on the road shoulder, having a steel column barrier fence 6 metres high was the second option. Also, there were options involving doing some cliff line or slope reprofiling so that you could create rockfall drop zones on the cliffs themselves. Another option involved heavy-duty rockfall netting of the cliff lines. We had received from the Swiss Geobrug company a lot of products that they use to try and contain the rockfall problem in the Swiss Alps. Another option was using a bridging structure of some sort, more of a rockfall portal, either made of steel multi-plate arch or a reinforced concrete portal tunnel.
Greg did a tremendous report, but when we actually started trying to implement what he suggested, what we found out was that there's some major OH&S issues for workers, because a lot of the rock falls will come from one or two levels above the road, up to sort of 120 metres above the road, and not even the extended platforms could reach a lot of these areas. So we actually looked to abseil from above to remove rocks. It was one of the techniques suggested. To do that, you actually had to secure the area above you so it wouldn't actually bring rocks down on top of you. So actually we started looking at the whole process. We actually found that, A, the cost escalated from the sort of $3.5 million initially to something less than $9 or $12 million at that time. And also we said we actually couldn't secure the site from above us. So basically said, oh, we don't think we can do this. And so we had to then go back and look at something else.
In mid-1999, the RTA started developing a new procedure with the intention of making it capable of assessing a wide range of slopes and getting valid comparisons between them. So it commissioned external consultants. The state was divided into seven regions for a slope risk assessment study. Greg Kotze of GHD Longmac reflects.
Alphalan was given the southern region, which extends from Sutherland to the Victorian border. And we ranked all the unstable sites, the cuttings and embankments over that vast area. And it became apparent to us through our assessments that the section of Lawrence Hargrave Drive came up number one in terms of priority requiring treatment.
Meanwhile, the rock problem persisted. Ian Stewart is a geotechnical specialist at the RTA.
Right at the end of 2000, we had a car hit by a shower of rocks, one of which went through the front passenger's window and landed between the front passenger's legs. It didn't hurt her, but it gave her a fairly nasty fright, as you can imagine. The remainder of the shower were much bigger, up to about 300 millimetres across. They smashed into the back of the car. If the car had got there about a 50th of a second later, the biggest of those would have gone into the back seat with two kids.
Well, I was concerned that the rockfall actually increased, judging by the amount of rock we're now getting in the rockfall pit. We're becoming increasingly concerned about risks to people as well as legal risks to the authority.
In view of the dangers, GHD Longmac were again consulted to access the rockfall issue from a risk management perspective, and their report discussed a comprehensive range of solutions. They ranged from permanent solutions involving the construction of a major bridge or tunnel to a risk management solution involving some engineering works plus road closures after rainfall when risks increased. Permanent road closure was also considered. But all the while, the rocks kept falling.
In about a month or 6 weeks, we had three serious incidents. We had one block of 6 or 8 tons fall off the middle headland and land in the northbound lane. There was a car coming south as it fell, and the driver saw it coming and put a foot down to try and get past it because it was too close to stop. The rock hit the road as she was going past, split in half, and about 3 tons of it bounced sideways into the side of the car and knocked the car into the guardrail. It was still drivable and she kept going. But clearly if she'd been going north, that would have been curtains because it would have landed straight on top of her. About a month later, I believe, there was another incident where a smaller rock went into the back seat of a car with only the driver in it. So again, no one was hurt. But again, a pretty near miss. And I believe there was another incident where a truck ran into a fallen rock.
The risk management option was selected, and this included a rockfall ditch plus a low berm to contain the rock, a geobrag fence, and sophisticated warning signs, boom gates, and a rainfall detection system. Bob Webb explains.
We shut the road for a period of 6 to 8 weeks, and we constructed a new high-tech geofence around Headland 1 to control the rockfall on that. We scaled the face around there too. They got up there in cherry pickers and in man boxes hanging from cranes, and using manual tools largely, brought down any loose material at all on the face. After we'd done that, we did a lot of rock bolting and meshing around Headland 1, and then we got the people in and built the fence.
The autumn of 2003 was the wettest for some years on the south coast. The RTA's consultants, aware of the link between rainfall and rockfalls, recommended that a rainfall protocol be introduced that would automatically close the road after more than 35 millimetres of rain had fallen.
In 2003, started raining consistently, and that's where the problem started at that point of time. because the road was being closed about every fortnight for a period of 1 or 2 days, and the community got very agitated because they were under the impression the work we had done had been sufficient enough to keep the road full time, and they weren't very happy with the road being closed all the time.
We found ourselves caught between some very soundly based recommendations about risk level and the fact that this was creating a really intolerable problem for the local community, and that they would never know whether the road was going to be open and may well find themselves or part of their family and their kids on the wrong side of it when it did close. So it was creating substantial disruption.
In March of 2003, the New South Wales Minister for Roads visited Wollongong and was met by a delegation of local residents demanding that a permanent solution be found. Mel Bilonevsky recalls.
That started the whole train of events off where we had to review, you know, we were given instruction by a minister to review the rainfall protocol. We engaged another consultant to review that. And in the end, the long and short of it was that next consultant said that even though we reduced the risk of life from 1 in 10 years to about 1 in 40 years, including the rainfall protocol, the reality is we should be targeting something like 1 in 1,000 years to reach these so-called Australian guidelines, geomechanics guidelines. Now, there's a lot of debate about that, but the bottom line, I'm sure, was that the road was closed in July of 2003 after that report because we couldn't guarantee the risk of life to come anywhere near that. Shortly after we closed the road in July, we had those sea swell events where we had pounding seas come in and undermine the embankment at the amphitheatre, and the whole road cracked open and the tow and the embankment started slipping away from the road, to the point that had we not had the road closed, we would have had to close it anyway.
In August of 2003, it was decided to close Lawrence Highgrave Drive for an indefinite period. At that point, the community became politically active.
We marched from Scarborough School to the picket line at this end, and at that particular time it was really heated, and they had the police there and security, and that people were quite wild because they knew that it's going to be a long time. You know, you had your Greens, you had your Liberals, you had your Labor people, you know, you had your independent people talking and that, and the RTA was just, they were saying one thing and people wanted something else, or one part of the people wanted something else, you know, and they wanted to smash the picket line down. I mean, I know about picket lines, and I know about unions, and I know about, you know, the feelings of people.
All the other closures, we were told right over, the road is closed for a period of X amount of weeks or months. We could wear that because it was light at the end of the tunnel. But when they closed at this time, they said it is closed indefinitely and may not open again. That made it pretty hard because it affected the our business, the Scarborough Hotel, went down to 50% of its turnover. My son said to Carl Scully, how would you feel if Mr. Carr said to you, I'm going to cut your wages in half this week? He said, I wouldn't like it. He said, well, that's what you're doing to us. The Clifton Hotel has gone broke. The service station at Stanmore Park has gone broke. And we lost some good staff over it. We employed 3 apprentices. You've got the school that's probably going to lose a teacher because the kids from Colcliffe, which is, what, a 10-minute drive to school, have got to go around the top. So it's affected business, it's affected the schools, it's affected the community to a great extent, but I still think it's drawn the community closer together.
The road's very important to the residents, right? Because it's a lifeline, isn't it? I mean,
some residents want it shut and consider it like to be a little isolated, dreamy village. But this road is most important to Wollongong, because how else would you go out of Wollongong, which we have? We've had major bushfires and we've been locked in here for a week because the two top roads going out, this has gone out. Had to go all the way down for an hour to get in there. And so it's most important when Wollongong is about to become a suburb of Sydney, it's most important that it has alternate reasons. And, of course, the fog is one, bushfire is another one, and storms.
The RTA recognised that short-term solutions were no longer an option. In September 2003, they invited proposals from the private sector to form an alliance project, a first for the RTA. Barclay Molan, were chosen as the construction firm, Monsal Australia as the design entity, and Coffee Geosciences as geotechnical engineers. Peter Stewart, the Alliance champion, explains.
Alliance Projects is trying to overcome some of the bad habits, if you like, that have developed in the industry over the years. Trying to get everybody to behave in the same way is fine, but you can't really drive that unless the commercial model supports it. And an alliance does that. It actually overcomes the traditional mistrust that seems to have pervaded the industry, that the client owner doesn't trust the contractor and he doesn't trust the consultant. And so the ring of mistrust carries on. The only person who can break that is actually the owner by saying, hey, I'm going to do something different here. I want to actually do business on a better basis, a better foundation. And so he sets in place a process whereby you don't tender for it in the traditional manner. You don't price it and get accepted on the lowest dollar. You actually put forward a team that actually can demonstrate they can perform together, they can integrate. And you put underneath that a model that will help them continue that process all the way through to the end. An alliance project could be described as starting with a blank page and saying, okay, what do we want to build here? And so you actually have to develop the option that you want to build from scratch and then put in place the approvals, and then the process goes on from there.
So is it actually still being designed as it's starting to be constructed?
Absolutely. It's fast track in many ways. It's fast track through the approval process as well as the DNC process.
Aren't there some pitfalls in that? Because if you haven't worked out your final design, you could face problems during the construction. That's why normally the plans are all finalized before.
Well, the risk profile is different. But remember, the client is part of the alliance now. It's not standing out there as a separate entity. He is part of it. So you actually have a fairly robust team of experts, which includes the owner. And you also have an independent assessment as well, which the owner employs independent people to audit and review the process to make sure it's robust. Sure, the risks are still there, and we actually cost those risks.
Do you share the risks and do you share the successes and contribute to the failures, if any?
Absolutely. That's part and parcel of alliance. The risk profile changes, and to an extent, the client parties take on risks they're unfamiliar with. A constructor will take on a client risk. A client will take on a construction risk. And the designer is taking on construction risk and owner's risks. And so it's very much part and parcel of the alliance. The rewards, of course, are shared equally as well, so that it is equitable. It's quite unusual for the RTA to embark on this, and it's a bit threatening for them. There's mixed feelings within the RTA. Some are for it, some are against it. And that's understandable.
Peter Stewart describes the process in arriving at the final design.
We had a workshop whereby we asked about 30 participants for ideas. We all huddled down into groups and individuals and sketched out ideas. We initially developed 70 ideas. When we collated them, there were actually 26 distinct ideas in there.
And what were some of the more outlandish ones, do you remember?
The more outlandish ones, I think, certainly worthy of mention, was a floating bridge, breakwaters. We had dual-use tunnels. We were going to put the road and rail in the same tunnel. We had a separate tunnel for the road, just leave the rail alone. We had a bridge over the headlands, over the top of them. And then we had what we call the Italian solution, which was tunnel, bridge, quite dramatic.
From the 26 ideas submitted, 4 preferred options were presented to the community. In order to involve the community in the process, the RTA formed a consultative committee. Alice Eyre is a member.
This committee started off a little bit split between the people who wanted it opened instantly and the people that wanted it shut, and the other people that knew that it was essential we had to have the road, not only for ourselves but for Wollongong as well. And that it had to be built properly, not a temporary thing. And since then, we have become almost like a friendly family now. And things are getting solved very quickly and very smoothly. This is the first committee that's ever done this. We're going by the seat of our pants.
How important was the concept of aesthetics in designing this new road or bridge?
It was very important to us, to the extent that we've built in features that we believe are, you know, quite expensive features to actually make it more attractive. the final solution is two different bridges meeting at a point, and that we've made the northern bridge deeper than it need be, but so that when the two bridges meet, they are seamless. It looks like it's one bridge. That's cost money, but I think it's worthwhile. We don't want to produce a product that looks as if it's cheap and nasty. We want to make it look good for many years to come.
When you sort of came up with the final design, what was the community's response to this proposal then?
We presented the preferred option to the community consultative committee, and at the end of the presentation they clapped. From all the studies that have been done, it will have little impact on the environment. In fact, it's probably quite environmentally responsible solution in that it has very few points of contact with the natural environment, and it will allow the existing road just to go back to its natural state over time. It'll be environmentally very attractive. I think from a driver's experience, it'll be quite spectacular driving from south to north down the sweeping curve through the southern amphitheatre, and then seeing the bridge disappear around that headland and following the sweep around. It'd be a very dramatic drive, I would have thought.
What do you think about the plan for the curved bridge now, the two bridges together that the Arthur is going to build? How do you feel about that?
I don't care what they do as long as they do it quick.
I think it's great to people's feelings to drive through there and look at those big cliffs and know they're safe.
Do you love your road?
Well, I don't know if I'd love it, but I like to be able to drive on it. It was bloody handy.
Pat Simpson is a Stanmore Park resident.
I just want an option that is cost effective and that will give me the access that I used to have. I want access to the northern suburbs of Wollongong because that's where my friends are, that's where my social life happens. And I'm not talking trivially about that. I'm talking about services that are delivered to me that I have accessed over the years. As far as expense of the options is concerned, I want a safe option.
I just want to see the road fixed before I die.
When the new bridges will be constructed, do you think that'll be the end of your problems with Lawrence Hargrave Drive?
I think the bridges will deal with the issues in our worst area of Longside Drive, where we have the rockfall and the embankment failures. But we really haven't addressed all the other issues of Lawrence Hargrave Drive, of all the other slips that exist along it. And a lot of these slips aren't associated just with the road. They're global slips which the road sits on. In many cases, the road and the railway line sit on them. They extend beyond the railway line and they extend below the road as well. So it's not something that we can deal with ourselves. So, yeah, basically the road out on either end is still a problem which we'll have to deal with in the future.
That road will be the greatest tourist attraction in the south coast. We'll have tourists galore coming down through the Illawarra. I see the future for the businesses that are doing it tough now. When the road is opened, it's going to mean more jobs for the businesses that are there, and I doubt whether the businesses will be able to handle it.
I just stress again the enormity of the site. To have a site of this magnitude in terms of the geometry, the physiology, the geography, the geology, the rainfall, the climate, the ocean, all rolled into one, it's arguably one of the most challenging sites to put any road through. And I think that's what makes it so unique. And I don't think we'll find anything quite as challenging again on the Australian mainland.
This oral history project has documented the background and significance of the Coast Road, Lawrence Hargrave Drive, to the local community. It has also recorded the history, lives, aspirations, and occasional frustrations of some of the local people who rely so heavily on this road for access. Part 2 of this oral history project will document the challenges involved in the construction process. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.
This second part of the Lawrence Hargrave Drive Oral History Compilation was recorded and edited by Frank Hymans from original interviews with 15 key persons. It follows on from part one, which examined the history of the area and the circumstances leading up to the closure of Lawrence Hargrave Drive in August 2003. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority. In March of 2004, the Alliance team set up to construct the two bridges, put forward their preferred option to the RTA and the community. The Alliance was made up of the RTA, the client, Barclay Molam, the construction entity, Maunsell Australia, the designers, and Coffee Geosciences, the geotechnical consultants. It was an ambitious project, an impressive balanced cantilever bridge on the southern side that would join up with a major incrementally launched bridge to the north to form a seamless structure. Once the bridge had been chosen, the budget for the project was set at $49 million and time was of the essence. The Alliance team had already begun the process of assessing the environmental factors that could influence the project. Jay Stricker is the manager of the RTA's Southern Regional Office at Wollongong since August 2003.
If we go back to the 29th of August when the Chief Executive said, this is now your region and this project in particular and the Minister's giving you 2.5 years to have the road reopened, and the Chief Executive said, you know, you've got to really have a good look at the environmental impact assessment, get cracking on it straight away so we don't have any delays. So I immediately got onto our internal environmental team and said, I want you to scour that whole length of road, the marine environment, the escarpment, the cliff line, the cliff vegetation, seabirds, everything. Go right over everything, scour it until you can tell me that there are no triggers for a significant environmental impact, or conversely that there are, and then we'll deal with how we can mitigate them or avoid them. So that's what we did.
At the time, David Corrie was one of the RTA's environment branch experts.
Early on when we were scoping the study, our ecologist came back and said, well, I didn't see too much except the largest diamond python I've ever seen in my life resting in a cave. He came to the conclusion that it feeds off the bats that come in and roost in the cave. He said it was a very well-fed diamond python. So I passed that message on to the constructors. I said, well, by the way, when you're down there, just be aware. There's a diamond python there, relatively harmless unless you're a bat.
In the early stages, Coffee Geosciences carried out extensive geotechnical investigations. Michael Norman is Coffee's principal geotechnical engineer and a member of the Alliance leadership team.
First of all, we look at the regional geology, so we have a pretty good idea of the formations that we're expecting to have there. We then do some visual mapping of the faces so that we actually know where the faults are and joints are and what sequences are there. We look at historical records such as mining records, where the mine workings are. We look at all the reports that have preceded the project now. There was some seafloor mapping that was done just at the beginning of the project by other consultants. And then we use boreholes that we drilled from around the site, and we had to build up models along the whole of the project. We even used a technique similar to air photo interpretation, but it's done from a helicopter where we flew and took some high-resolution photos and built up a 3D model in the computer so that we could estimate size of boulders and the like. So it was pretty interesting, and we used some pretty innovative techniques. There were many things.
David Corrie helped to write the Review of Environmental Factors, the REF.
We started in earnest in December 2003 at Chatswood, which was the Alliance office, and we were working in there with the designers, Coffees, the geotech consultants, people from Barclay Molam, who were the builders, and we were writing the REF in there amongst the builders and the designers. And if you had a question on how do you pour concrete here, or we need the footprint for bridge piers, or any questions like that, we had it at an arm's length. And that was, I found, a brilliant way to do an REF, because we had our answers there and then on any aspect of design or constructability or what number of machines you would use to do this. And especially with the designers, we needed a photo montage very, very quickly. We had it in a day and a half. You know, nothing was too much. You could see that these builders and designers wanted to do something unusual, but I had to explain to the builders and say, look, fine, this is an urgent job, but we just can't go and build this thing. We have to go through an approvals process. And I explained the EIA process and what the REF was for. And there were some who just saw it as a hurdle to jump over. Why are we doing this? Why doesn't the government just pass a law? And some people think the RTA has more powers than it actually has, and they're still surprised that we are required to go through this process. It was pretty stressful to get this thing out. It was a real team effort, and we were working till 10 o'clock most nights, a lot of nights. But we got it out. We made the launch date, and post-REF, didn't stop there. We had to go and have a meeting in town with our legal branch and talk about what conditions to impose on the REF. And we were treading, no pun intended, we were treading uncharted waters. We'd never built on or so close to the ocean before. And we were dealing with the Coastal Protection Act, Wollongong LEP, and do things go below the mean high water mark or above the mean high water mark, and who controls the intertidal zone. Issues like that we had never dealt with before. It was very interesting, but we got it through.
Maunsell Australia is the design partner of the Alliance. Peter Whiten, as the design manager, leads the team that has delivered the design of the two bridges, one of which will be the first curved balanced cantilever bridge constructed in Australia.
Everything was very evolutionary during the design process. Once we'd settled on the concept of two bridges joining together in the middle to make a single structure, we had to then look towards our international team for the correct expertise. We brought down from our Hong Kong office one of our lead engineers in balanced cantilever bridges, because the balanced cantilever component of the structure is probably the first curved in situ cast balanced cantilever bridge in Australia. The incrementally launched bridge is also possibly the tightest radius incrementally launched bridge done in Australia.
In designing the bridges, loadings have to be taken into account. Professor Harry Poulos is a senior principal of Coffee Geosciences and an expert in foundations.
When we're designing bridges and their foundations, we look at a number of alternative scenarios and combinations of loadings. So we look at the weight of the structure itself, we look at the load, what we call a live load, in this case the weight of transport that's going to use it. We look at wind, and we have certain combinations of those that are credible, and then we look at earthquakes. And generally, we figure that you're either going to get an extremely heavy wind or you're going to get an extremely bad earthquake, but not the two together. And so we have standard combinations of loading that we use in design. It just depends on the circumstances as to whether it's wind or earthquake that is the most critical component for the horizontal or lateral loading.
Alex Dunstan is the RTA's project manager at the Southern Regional Office.
When we were workshopping the bridge alignment, we had in the back of our minds that any alignment would be better than the alignment that we had on the old road. The old road wasn't designed to any particular road design and couldn't possibly meet any particular road design, and people had been driving around it for years and years and years, and that was what was there. And what we were going to give them was a much better alignment. The curves would be longer and the alignment would be much better. And so in that context, the design proceeded with the bridge being two curves, the balanced cantilever bridge being one curve, curving around the embayment, the incrementally launched bridge being another curve, curving around the headland, and those two curves joined. When we came to review that design, and the design had progressed considerably, the road design section pointed out that cars can't go from driving around one curve to driving around another curve without going through a transition. And that what was going to happen was that the cars would, when they got to the end of one curve, would try and drive through the transition and they'd be on the opposite side of the road. And obviously we couldn't have that. And so the whole design was reviewed and a transition put into the bridge. And that caused, I think, quite a lot of communication between the various elements within the RTA and within the Alliance and within the Alliance partners. If that was a normal contract, that would have incurred an incredible cost to the whole process. And we were almost in a position where we were, at that stage, boring the piles. And yet the design was changed, the piles were slightly relocated, and the process went on. So the alliancing process has been superb for being able to deal with these issues quite immediately and get through them at minimum cost.
Peter Stewart, the Alliance champion, is responsible for the overall performance of the Alliance partners.
I got involved in the design, particularly in design meetings and resolving design issues which come up daily at that stage. And we discovered there were so many issues that had to be addressed and locked away, as we call them. We had to make a decision and move on. And that was quite a tricky process because really the sky was the limit, and so you could move any direction you wanted. We had to start nailing things down. So we created what we called a frozen list. And so when we made a decision, we put it on the list and said, that's the decision we've made and it's frozen, and signed off and moved on to the next one. But we kept finding we had to go back and unfreeze. So we came up with a new term, which was minus 273 degrees centigrade. This one really is frozen and you can't change it. Because we tended to unfreeze things and say, look, maybe there is a better way of doing it. And this is, it is an iterative process design. It's very involved in actually doing that, actually saying, what's the fundamental shape of the piers? What's the fundamental shape of the deck? What can we change? What can't we change?
Mark Sinclair is Alliance Senior Project Engineer from Maunsell, Australia. He comments on the design changes that took place during the early days of the project.
Everything has changed on the job. The piers themselves have changed, the pile caps have changed, the pier head itself has changed, the offset on the pier head has changed, the segment lengths have changed. Segment widths have changed slightly as well in order to accommodate different geometry. The main bridge at the north, in order to meet some of the alignment criteria, has been slightly widened over parts of it. There's been an awful lot of changes that are all significant, but they've all just come through the evolution of the design and interaction with the site people.
One of those changes was the redesign of a pier on the balanced cantilever bridge, as Peter Stewart points out.
One of the interesting things at the start was that we suddenly discovered that Pier D was rather dangerously close to an old boiler that was part of the coal mine, the original coal mine. So this was a very important heritage item. And so panic mode went in, pressed the button and redesigned the foundation to miss the boiler. So we changed the whole piling configuration. We changed the pier base shape. We did everything to come away from the boiler and afford some space for it so we wouldn't have to undermine it or dislodge it or damage it in any way. And that's something an alliance can do, but in other types of contract you come to a bit of a stalemate and there's letters flying back and forth. So we were able to solve it within days and on we go and actually benefit from it. It was quite interesting. I think the pile cap and the pile design became more efficient as a result of that little pressure that was put on.
Mark Sinclair adds,
the balanced cantilever bridges that have been built in Australia have had generally only one degree of curvature to deal with, or one alignment to deal with. Most of them have been built on a straight alignment. This is the first one that I'm aware of that's built on a radius. That induces torsion into the pier and also tends to rotate the pier. So part of our things to assess and include for and make sure we don't overlook is that we pre-aim the bridge as we build it to some theoretical point in space so that when the two pieces get close and we have to join them, that they're relatively speaking in the right spot and that we've allowed enough for the sag that occurs just due to the weight of the concrete, but also that we cater for any rotational torsion that takes place as a result of the curves that we're building the bridge on.
Work on site began fully in May 2004. Peter Stewart recalls.
The major task was building access roads so that we could get down to the shoreline so we can actually start building this structure. And it also takes the workforce away from the danger areas, because the one thing that's paramount in this site is safety, and just getting everybody in a safe environment was primary to us.
We've had to bring in excess of 25,000 tonnes of rock in order to build our accessway down to the water from the original road alignment. That road in itself is about 5 or 6 metres wide. It's going to take a lot of heavy construction planned over quite an extended period. It's subject to weather. We've had the issue of the ocean. The ocean levels haven't been too extreme, but there's one or two days last week where it was breaking over the top in quite spectacular fashion.
Steve Montgomery is a site supervisor on the Lawrence Hargrave Drive project.
There was a really big swell the weekend before Easter. That did a lot of damage to our temporary roads, which means we have restricted access until we get excavators to clean them up. Early May we had another one, which is very, very big seas that caused us a bit of grief. I had to relocate the workers. They just couldn't go down there. You know, the waves breaking onto and over the rock wall, 10, 12 metres.
Tony Wood is General Superintendent on site.
It's very, very narrow gutted site. It was always going to be a logistical nightmare. Because of the nature of the terrain and the geography of the job, our biggest challenge is getting gear to the front, like getting all your equipment up to the work face. The key is to get everything coordinated and just in time so we can proceed with the gear, and all the guys don't get held up because they haven't got gear.
Were you worried about the safety of your workers because of rock falls that happened there?
Every day. We've identified a few potential dangerous areas that certainly are a no-go area for the guys. Even as recently as this morning, there was a rock had come down onto the road, possibly caused by this heavy rain early this morning. So, yeah, it's a live site. We certainly realise while we're there. I have seen some fairly large falls come down into the catch pits up on what we call MCA5. And, if those catch ditches weren't there, that certainly would have caused some damage.
How big was the rock this morning?
Well, it was hard to tell. It had fragmented, but I would imagine it was probably about the size of a small coffee table.
For a project of this size to be successful, the skills of many categories of engineers, supervisors and workers were brought together. Steve Montgomery explains his role on the team.
For the supervisor, most are carpenter background, and the basic thing is being able to read a plan. If you can read a plan, you can virtually build anything, and we're the ones that take it from plan to reality. With a supervisor, probably the biggest skill you need is people skills. You've got to make the men work together, because they're not there for a popularity competition. Some guys don't give a damn who they annoy, whatever, but they're a good worker. Other guys are too friendly and happy and chatty. They don't get anything done. So it's trying to manage all the workers, get the best out of the workers. And that's probably the biggest need of a supervisor, is being able to manage his work crew. The classic saying we've got on site is it's not rocket science. You know, they've been building bridges forever. It's a matter of managing our environment, and also managing the design and making sure that it all gets done as quickly as possible without breaking everyone's back.
Is it necessary to be a creative thinker in this kind of game?
Oh, yes, you must. If you can't lateral think, you can't be a supervisor. You think, you can plan, something's going to happen. You can spend weeks, or engineers can spend on paper saying how something's going to work, and it just doesn't work. It just physically doesn't fit. The line could have been on the wrong side of another line. And you've got to basically think how to solve the problem there and then with what you have around you.
By the end of August 2004, access roads were completed and piling for construction of the piers was about to begin. David Peacock is Alliance Senior Project Manager from Barclay Molam.
Well, I made a comment at the start of the job to my team. We don't want to get our feet wet. So the intent was to design the bridge so we didn't have to get into the water. Well, that didn't last long. As the design developed, we decided we had to get our feet wet or do something to keep the water out so we would not get our feet wet. And that took a bit of analysis and decision making, but in the end we decided, yes, we had to build piers which, had we not built our revetment, would be in the water. And we've solved that problem, and it's been solved very successfully.
There are now no piers in the water at all, are there? They're all on land.
Well, we've made the land.
Oh, you created the land with rock?
Yes. Yeah, we've built a breakwater and fill behind us, so had they not been there, all the piers would be in the water.
Michael Norman clarifies.
The balanced cantilever has four piers, so they're the four large piers in the southern amphitheatre, and there are seven piers along the rock platform for the incrementally launched bridge, and then there's abutments either end for the two. The balanced cantilever bridge and the incrementally launched bridge meet at a particular pier. They connect on the top of the pier, so they're not actually connecting on land, they're connecting on a pier up at some height.
Harry Poulos adds,
each individual pier of each bridge has to, of course, be custom designed. You don't have a standard design. Each one of those piers is dependent on the local geology, and so there had to be a very careful evaluation of each pier and sometimes of each pile within a group under a pier. And that's one of the characteristics, I think, of geotechnical engineering, is that you don't have off-the-shelf solutions to any problem. They depend on the ground depends on geology, geology depends on nature, and nature is not reproducible or reliable. There are a number of piers below which there are coal seams. And coal seams generally are a little bit of a worry because they tend to be a little bit softer, in some cases a lot softer, than the surrounding rock, and they perhaps are liable to change with time. However, it's not always economical, nor is it always necessary to go right through the coal seams, because these piles that we use for Lawrence Hargraves Drive can be quite large in diameter, and so we try and look at what the consequences are of actually founding above the coal seam. Will this potentially cause a problem with the capacity of the foundation? Will it potentially cause a problem with the settlement, the vertical movement of the foundation and therefore of the bridge support? Of course, these are things that we have to ensure. And in many cases, we found that we could found the pile above the coal seam rather than have to go through it.
On the 28th of August 2004, the first pile is to be drilled. David Peacock is looking forward to the event.
Are the piles driven deep into...
Well, the ones we're pouring tomorrow are 19 metres deep, but they're bored with an auger. They're 1,500 millimetres in diameter, that's 5 feet under the old system. They're piles to support the piers for the balanced cantilever bridge, and the first pier, which is Pier D, which is closer to the Clifton end, it's the first two piles, and that pier foundation will be poured tomorrow. Big day tomorrow, very important day.
On any project, unexpected events can occur. Mark Hendricks joined the Alliance as one of the Coffee Geosciences geotechnical engineers.
While they were excavating for Pier 2, the construction guys uncovered a block failure behind the pier, and there were some significant concerns about how that would affect the subsequent performance of that pier and where they should finally put the structure. The block failure in Wambara claystone had moved historically, probably due to a heavy rain event, and the movement we could see on the rock face was up to about 30 centimetres. And we were just concerned that there could be subsequent movement sometime in the future, and as a result of that, we were looking at designing the pier so that there wouldn't be no possibility of that movement affecting the structure. So we actually recommended that they excavate below the toe of the failure and then insert some compressible material around the pier so that if there was movement would be taken up by that material rather than affecting the pier. So that was a significant challenge, and we were able to respond to that quite quickly thanks to the way the Alliance is structured. Another interesting event was in regard to Pier A, the piling works there, where the two easternmost piles are actually going through the cliff wall, and copies were asked to be on site for one of those, where the piling rig actually broke through the cliff wall and was exposed to the open ocean. So that was an interesting time, and the construction team actually had erected a platform that was probably about 2 metres out from the cliff face. So the construction team basically walking out on this, more or less a diving board, to look at the way that pile was put in. But it was quite successful, and in the end it was close to what we predicted the conditions would be.
Peter Stewart corroborates.
There was problems at Pier D where we went through the coal seam and we were getting a contaminated water out of the piles, which we couldn't, of course, discharge into the sea. So we constructed a sediment pond, and the environmentalist came up with a flocculant that we could add, some chemical additive that helped all the sediment to settle out so that clean water was on the top and we could discharge that. So, yeah, but that was an issue, and that was solved very well environmentally.
By September 2004, piling was well advanced. Mark Sinclair outlines the events that will occur over the coming months.
For the main bridge, which is the balance cantilever, we've drilled some 1.5 metre diameter piles. There's typically six in a cluster on the main bridge, and there's four main clusters, one of each of these piers A, B, C and D. They're drilled through the alluvium, which we've basically put there, then through some coal, then into the sandstone underneath. And they go up to about 20 metres long, which is quite major, but on the overall scale of things, pretty standard stuff. So that gives us a nice stable starting point. On top of that, we're building a pile cap, which effectively allows the load from the bridge to come down the pier and then be distributed into those piles. That pile cap is, depending on where we are, anything up to about 8.5 metres by 7.5 metres by 2.5 metres thick. So it's quite a big lump of concrete, and there's 35 tonnes or thereabouts of reinforcement just within that concrete. From the top of the pile cap, we build the pier. Now the pier is 6 metres across, but only 2.8 metres wide, and it's 500 millimetres thick, so we've got an open rectangular box inside the pier. Those piers are built typically in about 4 metre lifts, so we'll build one segment, wait for it to gain enough strength for us to lift our forms, place our next lot of reinforcement, then jump again. So we build the piers in these 4 metre increments. When we get to the top of the piers, it gets a little bit tricky because we want to build something wider than the pier, and of course there's nothing to actually build that off. So short of scaffolding it all the way down to the ground, we've come up with a solution where quite a large platform, which will be 15 metres by 12 metres, will be built in space, and that'll be clipped onto the top of the pier. From that large platform, we build what we call the pier head, which has the full width of the road deck, which is approximately 12 metres, and we build 6 metres in total width. The pier is only 2.8, so we've got a little stub sticking out either side. That's all we plan to build off this quite large platform. We've got to do that in three stages. We've got to build the floor slab, we've then got to build the walls, which are about 6 metres high, and then we've got to put the road deck on top. For the incremental launch bridge, it has similar foundations to the main balance cantilever, except that the piles are smaller because the loads are much less. There's a couple of very odd-shaped piers that belong on the incremental launch, mainly piers 6 and 7, effectively because they're in the ocean or all but in the ocean. They don't have a regular number of piles. One's got 6 and one's got 5 piles in it. They're smaller in diameter. And as we get more towards the northern abutment, instead of needing to put piles in, we're able to just use spread footings, which are a common situation. So, and then as we get to Pier 1, because of the location of Pier 1, which is halfway up the hill, we've actually had to pile that one. And the northern abutment is also piled. So the substructure is not that greatly different, slightly smaller in pier size. The heights are also slightly less than what they are on the balance cantilever. One of the little things we're just fiddling around with at the moment is the geometry of the incremental launch bridge. You must launch an incremental launch bridge on a curve, and it must be on a constant curve. However, we also have an uphill gradient to contend with. Now, that doesn't sound all that unusual, and there's lots of incremental launch bridges launched uphill, there's lots of curved incremental launches, but when you put the two together, you end up with a complicated issue where our plan view of the road is a true plan, a horizontal radius of, for the incremental launch, 150 metres. But when you offset that on the 2.5% or nominal 2.5% gradient, you actually don't end up with a perfect curve. So the issue is, how do I launch something in a perfect curve and then still achieve effectively something in plan view that is in the right place?
And how are you going to do that?
We're just slightly fiddling with the radius, only by 40 millimetres in 150 metres, so it's a very small fiddle, but if we don't look at making a minor correction, we'll end up probably anything up to 90 millimetres from where we plan to be. There's issues also that we've addressed, such as the braking system. When you launch a bridge uphill, you've got to overcome gravity, and then when you have overcome gravity pushing it uphill, the last thing you want is for it to slide back down the hill. You actually launch it on a very low friction Teflon pad, which normally has a internal friction of around about 2.2%, give or take a bit. We have a downhill gradient of 2.5%, which technically means that if the bridge became active, it would become self-launching in the wrong direction. So we've got to avoid that. So there's detailed braking systems that have to be implemented, considerations for earthquake, there's considerations for how to wet cure the concrete because of the nature of the mix. It's got to be 7 days wet cured in an environment which really doesn't lend itself to having the hoses going, and I'm sure our friends at Sydney Water aren't too chuffed at the concept of us spraying too much water around, so we've got to have specialist mechanisms for the wet curing. We've got access issues that we've had to consider, where to get the men to the top of a 40 metre high pier, we can make them walk up 13 levels of stairs, or we can think of something a bit smarter. What we've done, because of the relative proximity in most locations to the road or somewhere that's our access track, we're looking at building a pedestrian bridge, which will be anything up to about 41 metres long. So we're building a bridge to build a bridge, and we'll drop that lightweight structure from the land side out onto the pier head, the top of the pier on the main bridge, where we have formwork travellers operating in sequence, one building a north section, one building a south section. So to get the manpower out there, we've come up with this method of quite a long walkway.
John Williams is Alliance Construction Manager.
From now on to completion of the project, what do you consider to be the greatest challenges you're going to have to face?
Apart from the weather, hoping it holds out for us, is the construction of the balance cantilever segments. Now, we have a crew that hasn't done this sort of work before. We've got a teacher crew. We've got to get a cycle time for each segment down. The more we get that cycle time down, is the faster we can bring in the project.
By January 2005, the travellers, imported from Slovenia, were ready to support the formwork for the balanced cantilever bridge. Milestones were being met, as Tony Wood points out.
Getting the traveller operational is a big milestone. We've nearly completed another important milestone, which was the pier heads. And once the pier heads are done, then the traveller is the next milestone that we achieve. We're also about to launch the first incremental launch section today. Hopefully that should go right. All equipment running well, we should launch out today.
And what time is that happening on site?
That's happening pretty much as we speak. And then we'll be able to pour the next segment for the incremental launch bridge. Yeah, milestones being hit all over the place in the next few weeks.
Mark Sinclair foreshadows events that will occur over the next 4 to 6 weeks.
I'd say about February, March 2005, the project will really start to take on a different dimension. One of the most spectacular times will be when the incremental launch is just about at its full length and the balanced cantilever segments are built but not joined. You've got a 50-odd metre long cantilever, which is a big lump of concrete swinging around in the breeze, not joined, just hanging up there in space. And I think people, if they're able to be there at that particular time, will be quite surprised how it all goes and how it all happens.
By June 2005, the project was well advanced, as Steve Montgomery reports.
All piers are finished. The incrementally launched bridge, the northern bridge, would have been finished by now, but the piers aren't ready. So it's gone ahead better than scheduled, and it's got 4 more pours to go. There is 7 piers on the north bridge and the 4 major ones for the balanced cantilever on the south. Pier D, the southernmost one, the pier's finished, and there is 10 pours either side of the pier. As of today, they've poured 8 to the south, which means they've only got 2 before they reach the southern abutment and join back onto land again. On the north, they're getting segment 8 ready now. So next week they'll pour that on Wednesday. So then they'll only have 2 more. I'm on PC, which is the next one north. I poured segment 7 south yesterday, which means I've got another 3 to go before it meets D. And on the north, same thing, I'm getting segment 8 ready, which means there's another 2 after that. And then all that big formwork structure goes back to where it came from, back to the middle of the pier, so they can be dismantled and moved over to the next 2 piers. So all the piers are finished. The south abutment is finished where we meet the old road. The incrementally launched bridge at the north, as I said, has got 4 more launches to go. They also started the gabion baskets, the wire baskets with the basalt. There is a lot of work around the pine trees to stabilise the bank. That started about 2 weeks ago. And further north, around what they call Guardy's Point, which is the only variation to the job, the road wasn't wide enough for a semi and a bus to pass. So as a variation, we are now widening the road and putting a cantilevered walkway all the way around the northern headland.
What's been your best day on this particular contract, do you think?
The 4 large piers where I did the pile cap, they're the largest piles on job, 160 cubic metres in each one, and they're just one massive block of concrete. They were quite challenging because they were our first big pours, and the concrete that we're using is what they call a 50 MPa RTA mix. It's a very unique blend of concrete, which makes it very challenging, especially in the early days for the batching plant to get the consistency right. I think what is going to be the one everyone's looking forward to is when the 2 piers touch, when we can shake hands with the next pier. I think that's going to be, you know, a real highlight when my pier touches up against Pier D, and hopefully the surveyor's got it right and they line up perfectly.
In terms of the concrete quality, that had to be absolutely impeccable. Some of the RTA people who've been working on bridges, concrete bridges, for a very long time are just saying, you know, the quality of the concrete on this bridge exceeds anything that we've done before. You know? It exceeds our own standards for concrete quality, which was quite amazing.
Mark Sinclair elaborates.
It's a fly ash blended cement, which gives enhanced durability, but also allows for construction to occur in a reasonable time frame. One of our major concerns, of course, is given where we're building this particular structure, it's probably the most exposed bridge in, well, certainly in New South Wales, and one of the most exposed in Australia. It is subject to a lot of salt spray and reinforcement, and concrete doesn't usually go for longevity, but in order to address those issues and hopefully come up with the best solution, we tossed around lots and lots of ideas in regard to coatings, different types of steel for the reinforcement, none of which quite satisfied our longevity goals. What's been addressed and what's been incorporated in the substructure of both of these bridges, the incremental launch and the balanced cantilever, is cathodic prevention. Cathodic prevention is effectively a system where a small current is applied into the reinforcement, which is such to overcome the currents and electron movements, etc., that would normally result in the onset of corrosion. So by putting a small amount of current into the structure, you're actually able to prevent the corrosion from starting. So that in itself is an innovative solution for a otherwise fairly major disaster that could be looming years from now.
Is that current going to be continuously going through the structure?
Yes.
For the rest of its life?
Yes. We've installed titanium anodes, and those titanium components have a certain current density that they emit, and the longevity of those anodes is expected to be in the region of 200 years. The design life of the bridge is around 100 years. It effectively drives the corrosive ions, which are effectively the chlorides, out of or away from the reinforcement, and effectively passivates the reinforcement in that fashion.
Peter Whiten confirms.
It won't hum, it won't be warm. The amount of current that runs through the actual computer that controls the current actually needs more current than what actually runs through the bridge. But it is an extra $1.5 million that the RTA have decided to put against this bridge, because this will be an iconic structure. This bridge, I think it's going to be noticed by people, and you know, people are going to travel to see it. And a bit like the Opera House or the Harbour Bridge, They didn't actually represent very good value for money at the time they were constructed, but nobody would argue against not having them now.
When did they start building the actual deck of the bridge?
That has started for the Balance Cantilever Bridge. We've poured two segments of Pier D, and by the end of this week we should pour another two segments on Pier C. So we're starting the segment construction process. We should be able to get a segment out per week, and there's 10 segments for each traveller to produce. A total of four travellers. So we get four segments out a week for four travellers.
In order to build the bridge deck for the incremental launch, what we've done is we've set up a purpose-built mould which will produce segments up to 15 metres long. What effectively is done there is we achieve one segment per week. A segment length is usually typically half of a span, which our typical spans are 30 metres, so our standard segment length will be 15 metres. So every week we place reinforcement, we pour concrete, we stress some cables, then using a lift and push jack, which is called an Ebbersparker, we push out this 15 metres of bridge, and then we go through the system again, and at the end of the day we will have launched 14 segments and we'll get the bridge in its final position. In order to launch one of these bridges, you have a heavy steel nose which bolts onto the very first segment. The reason for having that nose is it's actually lighter than the concrete that would otherwise be there, and as you push this out, the nose arrives ahead of the concrete at a pier. So once that launch nose arrives, it's jacked up slightly and then pushed through. The launch nose, in our case, is around about 18 metres long, which is 60% of a typical span. So by the time we've finished the incremental launch bridge, the formwork travellers should be just coming free of the main bridge on piers C and D, and then they'll relocate to A and B. So the incremental launch bridge will be finished first from a bridge deck perspective. The launch nose will then be removed, and then eventually the balance cantilever bridge will somehow join up at Pier 7, and eventually we'll have a continuous structure.
As is typical with modern concrete bridges, the two bridges are pre-stressed, as David Peacock informs.
Now, pre-stressing means usually when you cast a precast beam, the strands will be stretched against two strong backs, and then you pour the concrete around them, and then you cut the strands. Here you pour the concrete, feed the strands through ducts. When the concrete's strong enough, you then stress them to hold that segment against the last one you poured. And that goes all the way back to the pier head at the top of the first pier, so they're tied back to each other all the way.
Working more than 20 metres high, safety on site has become the most important consideration for the Alliance, as Peter Stewart confirms.
There are plenty of hazards on the site, but I'm never worried about it because there's a high level of safety consciousness right through the whole site, and I'm very impressed with the whole attitude to safety. And whilst it's an incredibly dangerous site, maybe that heightens the awareness and heightens people's attention to detail. That's good.
Steve Montgomery adds,
we haven't had any lost time injuries yet. We got an award, which I think was to December, of 100,000 man hours with a lost time injury. It's a physical job, so you do get, like I said, strained muscles, so we make sure that they're treated straight away. It's obviously in our best interest to keep the men at their best, and also for them, for their own personal, you know, the old motto, you know, you come to work to go home.
Are there any medical facilities around in case an accident?
Yeah, we have a trained occupational health and safety person on site with his own dedicated office and facilities for minor injuries, and anything major is, of course, taken to the nearest hospital. And the closest hospital here is Coaldale, which is probably about 5 minutes down the road.
All this time, while the bridges were being constructed, the road was closed, affecting businesses and the community. Ros Mustin was engaged as the RTA's community relations manager. My role was to serve the minister's promise that communication between the community and the RTA would be improved. It's been 2 years of crisis management. I feel it's a crisis for somebody when they ring in and they say, Ros, it's a business person, seven cheques have just bounced. I don't know where I'm going to find the money to pay the fee on the cheques that have bounced. I'm dependent on somebody coming into my shop and buying some things tomorrow so that I can honour the cheques. There are eight villages affected by the road closure. There are sporting clubs
in those villages. Football sort of things in the winter and surf club type things in the summer. Those sporting clubs provide a community service, a social service. And those clubs are supported by donations from businesses. When the businesses started to lose money, the sponsorships to the clubs ceased. And the clubs then made, first of all, the businesses made contact with us and said they couldn't sponsor the clubs. And the clubs made contact with us and said that they didn't have the money to keep running, and they were also losing, they couldn't recruit for their teams because some of the children were too far away to come to training, etc. This is where the Community Support Fund comes in, because when the minister announced that the road would close and there'd be a budget for repairing it and there would be a time frame for repairing it, he also announced that there was a $2 million Community Support Fund. And my role in the project is to facilitate the allocation of the fund. So I suddenly had a budget where I could offset expenses and costs that were caused by the road closure. We expected people to come to us with submissions for money or for other sorts of support, because a lot of these problems you can't solve with money anyway. They were not always able to put their submissions forward to us, so we had to assist. Often we helped them develop the case. We then often helped them develop the solution, and then we often implemented the solution. Now, that's a little odd for this sort of situation, but here you've got perhaps a set of shopkeepers who've put all their casual staff off. They're working very long hours. It's impacting on their family. It's impacting on their health. It's impacting on their finances. They really don't have a lot spare to come in and do all of the work that they need done to support them. By the end of July 2005, events on site were progressing rapidly, according to Alex Dunstan.
Within about a month, they'll start to pour the final sections of the balanced cantilever bridge. And there's basically 10 segments to that, and they pour out from each pier. So that's 20 segments on each pier, and they pour two of those segments every week. So I guess there's about 3 months of intensive concrete pouring left. The milestones for me will be getting the footpath, which council are going to build, between the bridge and Clifton complete. If we can do that, then we've achieved the connection not only of the road, but also a footpath connection between Clifton and Colcliffe, which will be a huge community asset. I guess within the Alliance, we now are up to the point where the geotechnical works are almost complete. The widening of the northern headland is progressing well. The finishing works on the incrementally launched bridge have to be done, because the incrementally launched bridge is now in its final position. And the bridge deck on piers A and B for the balanced cantilever bridge need to be complete. And then, of course, the landscaping and the finishing off works, including the removal of some of the revetment works at the bottom of the balanced cantilever bridge.
David Peacock summarises.
Well, once the decking's done, then it's the finishing works. It's the black topping for the servicing, the line marking, New Jersey curbs, and just the tying into the roads at both ends. Where the bridge finishes, there's an abutment, and that'll be done concurrently with the decks, so they'll come together at the same time. We've got to do some work on the existing road around the northern amphitheatre as it goes around into Colcliffe. That will need to be rebuilt, resurfaced, new guardrails, and we're looking at improving the road around the northern headland, which we call GD5, as it comes out of Colcliffe, to improve the passing distance between opposing buses and trucks. Currently they cross over the double line.
On the 15th of November 2005, the final concrete pour on the deck took place, making a continuous structure for the first time. Sean McCallion was the foreman on the job that day.
This morning we put the last of feet into the slab for the bridge, the final closure pour. We fixed the rail off in there, cleaned it out, made it ready for concrete, and then we poured the final slab about an hour and a half ago.
Is the bridge now walkable?
Yes, you can walk from one end of the bridge to the other.
So the bridge is all there now?
The bridge is all there. We've just got two expansion joints to put in. Three, actually.
As well as being a significant employment generator in the area, the bridge has provided an opportunity for many people to learn new skills. Tony Wood explains.
There's been some good tradesmen come out of this job. There's been some guys who have surprised themselves, I think, about what they can achieve. We've had house carpenters who have become terrific bridge carpenters and dogmen that have become good riggers. There's some good guys have fronted up here and had a crack at this job. Not everyone's worked on a bridge before, and this is a first for quite a few of them.
The date for the official opening of the bridge was set as the 11th of December 2005, and a competition was launched for local school students to coin a name for the new bridge.
Are the community getting excited about this bridge?
Oh, I think they're beside themselves here. When we first arrived here, I remember talking to some members of the community, and they were almost in disbelief that we were here, and they certainly didn't believe we were doing anything. They thought we used to go behind those closed gates for every day and come out and nothing was happening. But now you tell them, they all know the opening date now, and they're all pretty ecstatic, yeah.
Are there any celebrations planned for the opening of the bridge?
Many people are planning many celebrations. There's an almost out-of-control aspiration for celebration when this bridge opens. We're receiving submissions from all sorts of people who have good ideas and who fear that the RTA may not be thinking about this. Charities are suggesting that they may organise the opening celebration so that they can promote their good works. Service clubs are offering to organise it so that they can have bucket collections for their good works. Commercial people are ringing in saying they've got the best idea for the opening and would we like to pay them to organise it for us. And the community people themselves are just in a party mood and wanting to be part of the partying. So yes, there will be celebrations. If the RTA doesn't facilitate celebrations, then they will be held anyway. On the 11th of December 2005, it all came together.
It's a beautiful Illawarra morning, and thank you all for coming. Let me first acknowledge Premier Maurice Yemma, who's come for this important event, Minister for the Illawarra, Dave Campbell, Minister for Roads, Joe Tripodi, my parliamentary colleague, Barry Collier, Member for Miranda, our federal member, local federal member, Sharon Bird, Lord Mayor and Lady Mayoress Alex Darling, Mayor Hamilton, fellow councillors, Mike Hammond, Acting CEO of the RTA, Dave Stewart-Watt, Jay Stricker from the RTA as well, representative of the Alliance, other special guests, and more importantly, local school kids from the Illawarra community. My name's Paul McClay. I'm the local state MP, and we'll start the morning very significantly and importantly with Cheryl Davis Fulcher, who will give us a welcome to country on behalf of the Wadi Wadi people.
Firstly, I would like to acknowledge all our official guests and the community, and especially the school kids that have turned out here today to witness the reopening of Lawrence Hargrave Drive and the official opening of the new Seacliff Bridge. The name Seacliff also has an Aboriginal perspective which can be related to the heritage of my people. The sea is a significant feature of the traditional custodians and as we are known as the saltwater people. The cliff is the face of the escarpment. The escarpment is the natural keeping place for rock shelters that signify the history of the Wadi Wadi people. Congratulations, Mackenzie. The name Seacliff can only be described as unique. What a spectacular view, which makes driving along Lawrence Hargrave Drive, crossing over the new Seacliff Bridge, an absolute pleasure. I acknowledge all who have been involved in the construction of this magnificent bridge. This landmark will be a prominent tourist attraction. This is an historical event and will certainly be talked about in many years to come. Therefore, on behalf of the Wadi Wadi people and the traditional custodians of this land, I welcome you to country. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl, for that important welcome to country. The Premier, Maurice Yemma, is absolutely insistent on being here today because it is such a significant piece of infrastructure for not just the people of Illawarra, but also for New South Wales. The RTA came up with an alliance to come up with a preferred solution which actually took away from the coast to build this magnificent structure called Seacliff Bridge. It's a $49 million agreement with the alliance to come up with a preferred option, which is, as you can see, an iconic, magnificent structure before us. The Premier has taken a certain interest all the way through because of what it means to the local communities. The fact that we have so many school kids here today to be coming across the bridge first is important and is the way that the Premier sees the future of the region and the future of structures like this. So I'd like to hand over to Premier Maurice Yemmer.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great day for us all. It's an example of good government action and government listening. Listening to what you've been telling us about ensuring greater safety and better access, of dealing with the issue of the rock slippage and getting some action taken. And we dipped into our state budget for $49 million to build this magnificent bridge. It is a great engineering feat, a very practical solution to what has been a very difficult problem here, and one that's compatible with the environment, and one which will see a reopening, a reuniting of two communities, cutting travelling times, better safety, better access. And Mackenzie, you are part of the history that we're making today. When your family drives along the bridge, you can very proudly say, well, I named that bridge and I'm part of history. We've waited long enough. The engineers have done their work, a smart, excellent design. The workers have done their job. The RTA have done their job. And the community have done their job. The uncertainty is over. The waiting is over. And I now, in the name of the community, very proudly name this bridge Seacliff Bridge and declare it open.
I'm now going to ask Mackenzie Russell to actually stand and unveil the sign for the new Seacliff Bridge. Okay, thank you. Mackenzie's just unveiled the sign and unveiled the plaque with her name very proudly put on there with the details of why she came up with the name. So, school kids, we're going to come along and meet, and then we're going to cut the ribbon, and then the walkers will begin.
Students from Stanwell Park and Scarborough Public Schools then witnessed the ribbon being cut and walked across the bridge together. One of the first to reach the other side was Claudia Schmidt.
Oh, it was really exciting being able to walk across the bridge. Like, I'm going to be able to see my friends a lot more often and ride my horse and all that.
Jessie Brown is a student from Stanwell Park.
Tell me, how long has it been since you've been able to go across this road?
2.5 years.
Yeah,
we've never
actually been across this road.
So what are your plans for crossing this bridge?
Going surfing. That's my plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, to use it to go surfing.
Christine McMaster had this to say.
It's a great feeling to be able to access the road again and have all the people be able to come down and go back up. So it'd be a lovely drive, be able to drive up and see the other side. I haven't been up to Stanwell Park since it's shut, so yeah.
Steve Montgomery was also among the crowd.
Steve, now how do you feel that this particular day when this final culmination of all your work?
Oh, it's great, mate. It's everyone's very happy. It's just a beautiful bridge. I didn't realise it'd be that spectacular until the full entirety is finished. It's better than what we all expected, I think.
How many months have you spent on it?
13 months I was on the project.
When do you officially finish on it, then?
This afternoon, that's it. That's it, yeah. Yeah. When it's back to the public and everyone's using it, you know, that's what we're after.
We also found Warren de Kluwert among the crowd.
I've travelled across the road, you know, the old road, taken all the horses into the coal mine and all that, and, you know, to be able to walk across now with my grandchildren, it's a really, really privilege. It really is.
Trevor Gardner expressed a dissenting view.
I liked it the way it was. I would have preferred to have the money spent on a cycleway and a footpath so my children didn't have to walk along Lawrence Hargrave Drive with the coal trucks. that was probably a more important issue than this was for the general safety and movability and commuting of the community. Kids can't walk between schools, walk between the villages without walking on Lawrence Lake Drive, drive the coal trucks or the cars.
Mackenzie Russell, who thought of the name for the bridge, is a student at St Bridget's Primary School, Gwynville.
Mackenzie, how old are you?
I'm 11.
Tell me, were you excited about this bridge when it was being built?
Yes, I was.
So how excited were you?
Very, very excited.
How did you come up with the name?
My mum knew about the competition before, and I thought about the area and the hang gliding, and I brainstormed some ideas.
Well, you can tell everyone that you opened this bridge.
Yes.
When you're very old and a grandma, you can tell your grandchildren about it.
Yes, I can.
Dane Montague, let us know this.
My interests are skateboarding, surfing, and bike riding, and yeah, lots of other things. And it'll be easier. I'll be able to do all those things with my friends and go to different places easier.
Ros Mustin summarised.
The community generally are very excited about the bridge opening. They're looking forward to reconnecting with friends and relatives. They're looking forward to getting back into their routine of where they like to shop and the way they like to travel to work. They're very excited.
Neil and Julie Martin come from Oak Flats.
Fantastic. Great.
That's beautiful. It really is. It's worth, you know, like it's been a long time coming, but it's worthwhile for the wait. Yes.
Now, what do you think it's going to do for this area, this new bridge?
Bring a lot of tourism to the area. Yeah. A lot of overseas visitors. Be very impressed.
Right. What about you? How's your life been affected by the fact that there wasn't any bridge?
Well, we used to always bring our children up here and watch all the hang gliders, but it got to the stage where going all the way around just took too long and what have you. So this way we'll be able to go back up and sit up there and have picnics and everything like that.
Diane Mitchell and Bronwyn Cupid express this view.
What do you think this bridge is going to do to the community?
I think it's going to boom the community.
Boom the community, yeah.
Whether they like it or not, tourism will just take off. Yeah.
Are you happy about that?
Yes, I am happy. I mean, Mum and Dad live down in Aussie, so we've got strong ties. My father was one of the original surveyors at my grandfather at Coal Creek Colliery. And then a foundation member of the Ostermere Surf Club, so our history goes back to, you know, the early 20s in this area.
I think you just can't stop history. Yep. I mean, it's just going to be part of, like, in another 50 years, you know. This is just going to go down in history as being a great event.
And I've got an extra special thing. I've got a blister, and I'm the first casualty on the Seacliff Bridge. So I got the first Band-Aid.
Good job.
Ray and Val Crump were enthusiastic.
This is a fantastic structure, though.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? Pleased I came, even if I did get wet.
It's all so different. There's been a lot of thought gone into it.
You like the look of the bridge?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I give them full credit for this one. But I was thinking in terms of the period ahead. You've only got one lane either way. What's the future going to be? In time, if this becomes as busy as it might do, they're going to have to search for extra space somewhere.
Oh, well, you won't have to worry, love.
No, I won't. I'm 80 now.
Peter Wolfe provides a professional opinion.
I was in the bridge section. I was bridge engineer operations. And this is certainly one of their better efforts, isn't it? It's a very fine piece of work. And it solves what's been an age-old problem here, of course. It's the solution, and I think they've gone a lot of thought and a lot of trouble to pick the right one. Now, it'll be an asset to this area. It'll keep this road open, and that in itself is a major achievement.
Ellis Eyre was a member of the Community Consultative Committee for Seacliff Bridge.
Well, we've pretty well got what we wanted. Everything works, and I can't see anything that we talked about in those times that they haven't been corrected and listened to, and it should be for 100 years. And as a local, I'm completely safe. Riding around here, there'll be no more rock shit me ever. No matter how big they are.
Looking at Lawrence Hargrave Drive as part of a bigger picture in a larger context, can you do that for me?
I was just reflecting, actually, on the way that the
focus on the project has changed somewhat, because in the beginning the impact was on the local communities, and the project was all about rejoining those local communities, particularly Colcliffe, Stanwell Park and Clifton and Scarborough. So it was a very localised focus. And then when we came up with this solution that was such a wonderful structure, and people like the local council, Tourism Wollongong, other organisations started to really take notice of that and see that this was in fact a completely new gateway to the Illawarra. And Tourism Wollongong in fact have been promoting this tourist drive now in Japan and Taiwan. And to some extent I'm a little hesitant about the impact that this is going to have on the local communities, because although there are some who really want the tourism dollar, there are other people who are seeing that their lifestyle will be changed forever by this new road.
Ros Mustin expresses this thought.
Do you think that some people are going to feel a bit sense of nostalgia about the old road being gone and so on? That's part of the history.
I became concerned about a sense of loss and grieving for the old road early on in the project. And it was a day that we took the Community Consultative Committee onto the site prior to the work starting. It was their last chance to have a look at the old road. And they walked in a gregarious, jolly group down the hill toward the cliffs. And I was walking along behind them and listening to them point out to each other features of the cliff, features of the road. They were using their own stories to explain to each other how they felt about the road. And my heart sank into my boots as I walked down behind them, because I thought, we thought we were dealing with conflict over road closure, but coming out the other end of this project, we've had people cut off for 2.5 years for something that they feel is part of their own identity, and it'll be gone. And they'll suddenly realise they'll never, ever have it again. And I started to become very worried that down the track we would have a different sort of conflict emerging out of grief, which would be very, very difficult to manage. And that's really when I started to think about oral histories. I thought that the oral history might give us a mechanism to create a memorial for the old road, something, a keepsake, something that people could put away and bring out when they wanted to, or show their children or their grandchildren when they wanted to tell their stories about what used to be there but isn't there anymore. I'd been involved with oral histories before, and I thought maybe that's the way.
How do you think Lawrence Hargrave Drive is going to be seen by the engineering profession in future years? How will they look back towards that one, do you think?
I think they will see it as a step forward in engineering in Australia. It's a very bold project to build two different types of bridge construction, particularly in such a challenging site. So, you know, in that respect, it's been challenging, and I think it will stand out as a landmark in engineering and indeed in road design. We've had some significant design challenges just in terms of the alignment of the bridges and so on, purely from a road safety driving sort of perspective. So from the traffic engineering as well as the civil construction, it's been quite a landmark project.
The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews were those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.